Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here as always to talk about stuff this week with two separate episodes. We also have an episode coming out this week about Logan, the superhero movie, last Hugh Jackman Wolverine movie.
Yes.
And we actually have already recorded that, although it might be coming out second. But spoiler-filled discussion. I mean, quick, it's a great movie, right?
It's a fantastic movie, yes.
So we had a lot to talk about there. That's a separate episode, though, because we wanted to just spread these out a little because there was a lot to talk about this week. That was our movie episode. This is our gaming episode because if you haven't heard, some big things have gone down in gaming lately.
Yes. What are they, Jonathan?
You have been playing the latest PS4 exclusive, Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yes, which I've recently discovered that title does not have a colon in the middle. It is just one fucking sentence. It is Horizon Zero Dawn. There are no subtitles. That is just the title.
I can't decide if that's bad or good.
I have no idea either. They should have just called the game Horizon Zero Dawn. Is a terrible addition to that title.
Yes, well,
It is one of the biggest discrepancies I've seen in quality of game and quality of title in a long time, because Horizon Zero Dawn is a really, really great fucking game that has a very silly title, and that the title card in the game would look unbelievably gorgeous if it had just said Horizon while the main character Aloy was looking over the horizon.
Yeah, that seems like it would be a better title for it. Although there's something wonderfully, like, PS2 era silly about the title Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yeah, it evokes something by evoking nothing, that's for sure.
That would be a great quote for, like, the Game of the Year edition. It evokes something by evoking nothing.
Yeah.
Sean Chapman, the Weekly Stuff Podcast.
There you go.
There we go. All right, so we know you love the game. Yeah. We'll talk about that a little bit. No spoilers for that.
Yeah, because I'm not even really deep enough into the story to give a lot of spoilers anyways. I've been doing a lot of side stuff in the game.
Nice. And I will be talking about, and you with me a little bit on the hardware side, the Nintendo Switch.
Yes.
It's just launched. Got mine in Friday. Took the day off work to play with it, and it was great. And the big game that launched with it, The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. And again, not going to talk about any spoilers with that game, because again, I'm also not done with the story there, so this will be one of our general impressions episodes. So come one and all to listen.
Yes.
My quick reaction, I love the Nintendo Switch. I think it's a really, really cool piece of hardware from Nintendo. And Breath of the Wild is nothing short of one of the greatest games ever made. And I hate to be, like, just jump on the fucking bandwagon.
Sure.
But here's the thing. Sometimes you can think with Zelda games that critics are a little boy who cried wolf with it.
Yeah.
Especially, like, I think IGN has called every 3D Zelda game the best Zelda game ever.
As someone who used to read a lot of IGN game reviews back when new Zelda games were coming out at a somewhat regular clip, yes, they have.
Yes, they have. So sometimes there's a little bit of that. But here's the thing. I have not even played most of the 3D Zeldas.
That is true.
When I say, like, I've played Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, and some of the old 2D ones. So I feel like I'm a little more unbiased on this.
Sure.
When I say this is a phenomenal game, I'm coming to it primarily from the standpoint of just a game, not as I'm someone who's played every Zelda game and gone kind of over the top with it a little bit.
Right.
No, this is an amazing, amazing achievement in video games and just pretty jaw-dropping. I was telling you this off the air that Saturday I played Breath of the Wild from when I woke up at like 9 a.m. to when I went to bed at like 1 a.m., with, like, little breaks here and there, but mostly I just played it and didn't even realize I was binging it that hard. And I don't know if I've ever played that much of one game in one day, even, like, a Persona or something. I don't think I've ever binged that hard. And I've only scratched the surface of it. This is a hell of a fucking thing. You can absolutely believe the hype on this one.
Okay.
So, yeah. And it's a good game to try out some new hardware with. So
sure, yeah.
Definitely. Most launches don't have some, like, it's a really weird thing for me playing the Nintendo Switch is that I'm used to getting, like, launch hardware and kind of the process I have with it of testing different things out and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, recently we had, like, the PS4 and the Xbox One and things like that. But normally with launches this day and age, you don't have, like, a big meaty game on day one like that to sink your teeth into, so you wind up hopping around and doing some other things. I mostly haven't. Like, I've mostly, and it's kind of a nice way to be able to test the console because that's a very much a day-to-day scenario for me. Not, I got these three games, I wasn't really interested in any of them, let's see what's good. Oh,
like,
I liked...
Yeah, let's play some fucking Need for Speed Rivals, because that's a game I would normally have bought.
Exactly.
If they didn't have, like, a weird deal for Target that I kind of basically got it for free.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and there's even, like, this, you know, the launch lineup is kind of scant for the Switch. There's 9 games in the eShop right now. But of those 9 games, there's actually a pretty big percentage that I would like to get and try out from, you know, new games like Snipperclips, which you and I just played some of, which is really cool. Can't wait to try more of that. The new Shovel Knight DLC is out, and then they have a complete collection. I've never touched that game, and I think this would be a cool way to try that out.
Sure, yeah.
Fast RMX, which I've been playing a little bit of, is this racing game that's on there. I think it's a, like a enhanced port, but with a lot of new stuff of a Wii U game. But to most people, even Wii U owners like myself, it's new. So
sure, yeah.
There's things like that. So there are other games out there that I would like to play for it and try out. But it's like, I don't have time. I'm just playing fucking Zelda. So it's a weird launch in that the launch lineup is technically skimpy, but I have no dearth of thing to play on it because
right.
I'm diving into this giant, giant game, the likes of which it's been a long time since a console launched with something like that. You know, Halo on
Xbox. Yeah, probably Halo on the original Xbox, the last time the console had like a really big sort of like platform defining game at launch.
Yeah. So anyway, but I've been playing with it a lot. It's cool. Got my Breath of the Wild case for it, which is okay. This is the one you'll find on Amazon. I think PDP makes these. They had them in a couple designs. And I like the design of it a lot, and it feels nice and durable. But inside, there's this, I haven't shown you this yet, Sean. Like, there's this little mesh case to, like, put the Switch in. But it's a little too narrow, and the Joy-Cons wind up feeling like when they're attached and you put them in there, like a little too constrained.
Huh.
And it is supposed to go in with the Joy-Cons on.
Yeah, because if it didn't have the Joy-Cons, it would be all loosey-goosey in there.
Yeah, so it's like a tiny bit too tight, but you can also just put it on top of the mesh and it's fine and it's good. It's got slots for game cards. So anyway, I like it. I'm having fun with it. I have not used the Pro controller yet. That's coming in tomorrow from Japan. I had to order it from Japan to get one. And actually, if I had gotten to play with the system like before I made that, I probably wouldn't have ordered one because I'm fine with the Joy-Cons. But we'll talk about all of that more later. First off, before we dive into the main topics and we'll figure out what order we're going in for all of this, any stuff like in gaming or news or anything we need to talk about before we get into our topics?
I think, there's that little bit of stuff about Destiny 2 that came out. I guess we should probably talk about that. We sort of talked about it when it was all rumored that like Jason Schreier had a Kotaku report that was basically talking about all this stuff, but Bungie did a couple of days ago come out and officially sort of talk about that Destiny 2 is obviously a thing that's coming around the corner, and there is an issue about what happens to your Destiny 1 characters when that game comes out, and they have gone with what Jason Schreier hinted at in his report several months ago, that like your appearance and all that stuff will stay the same. It seems like there will be, or you can carry it over, and it seems like there will be some sort of like, if you achieved certain like milestones and stuff like that in Destiny, there will be something in Destiny 2 that will recognize that. They weren't specific on it, but any abilities and items like gear, the Eververse like microtransaction stuff, none of that stuff will carry over. And so they have like just sort of officially put that out there, and it's all stuff that I'm basically fine with. The one thing that from like an ideological point of view, I think is a little bit weird is that the microtransaction stuff does not have something coming over, because I didn't spend any money on Destiny outside of buying the game and its expansions. But if someone did, I feel like, and maybe they would, that will be something that will carry over in some capacity. But that's the one part of the announcement that I was like, that feels wrong. Like if people spent real money to like get silver or whatever and buy some dances, let them keep their fucking dances in Destiny 2. At least that, like, maybe if they're
or
not
an equivalent,
all, or an equivalent, or like reimburse them for something that they can buy in Destiny 2 then, or something like that. That's, I think, would be a better solution.
I wouldn't be surprised if they do something like
that. Like, because there's definitely room for them to say that when the game comes out, of like, okay, this will be like some sort of exchange program or something for, I mean, who knows if there will even be a microtransaction component of Destiny 2 at launch. Like, we don't know anything about the specifics of that game. All we know is, by and large, you are starting Destiny 2 fresh with a effectively new character.
Yes.
That's what I want too.
Like, I had not thought of the microtransaction piece, and you're right, that's the only place it could get muddy. But my reaction to that is good. It needs it so badly, and I love Destiny. Great game. Had so much fun with it over the last couple of years. But it needs to be a fresh start.
Yeah.
And it needs to, you know, it needs for them to be able to do something new with it. And for me, it's like, I like Destiny a lot, but I'm not going to, it's not like, this is not like a World of Warcraft character or something that I've poured all this time and love into. It's, especially because you don't even fucking see your character's face in this game. So it's like, for me, I don't really mind any of that. And I'm more excited at the prospect of something new that I can really dive into rather than, I don't know, kind of a rehash of what we already had, or a half and half solution. You just can't take a half measure with this.
Yeah.
If you're really going to make Destiny 2 and not another Destiny 1.5, which is what like The Taken King and Rise of Iron were, which were great, but those are expansions. If this is a new game, it needs to be a new game.
Yeah, and it's also something where, like, I just wouldn't, especially with the abilities, like, I don't want to, like, be playing Destiny 2 and have, like play a Hunter class and have all the exact same abilities the Hunter class had in Destiny 1. Like, I'm really excited by the prospect of new classes with, like, you know, whether or not it's, like, another Hunter class and they're, like, using that same sort of model. Like, I expect there to be a lot of new abilities and for those to be interesting and different and them shaking up how that stuff works in a really fundamental way. That's really exciting to me in a way that, like, I don't want necessarily to just be, like, using the golden gun in the exact same, like, the exact same way that Destiny 1 did again when Destiny 2 comes out. Maybe they still want the concept of the golden gun power, but hopefully it would be, like, in a different, new, interesting way. And then also, as far as, like, gear goes, it's sort of the same thing. I don't want to be using the fucking Gjallarhorn and Hawkmoon for the fucking 50 hours playing Destiny 2 because I already did that playing Destiny 1. Like, you know, I don't even want them to necessarily be trapped in the box that says, like, they have to have all the different weapon types from Destiny 1 represented in Destiny 2. Maybe they don't want to have fucking heavy machine guns or something and have a whole other different sort of weapon system.
And then finally that, drop the hand cannons.
Yeah. No, nobody really liked them that much. Yeah, I'm really excited by the idea of them being able to start fresh with Destiny 2. And I'm excited by the idea of having all new Destiny to play that has learned from the mistakes of the past and is just completely unchained from that shit.
To me, the most exciting thing about Destiny was always kind of the sense of discovery.
Yeah.
And getting new stuff and getting new abilities. And, you know, the best moment in The Taken King was when you got your new fucking ability. And that was so cool, yeah, the way they introduced that. If you were just to rehash it and say, I got Gjallarhorn again. It's like, okay, that was cool when I got it. But it's not the kind of game that's built to be that, to me, like this repetitive grind. Even though, yeah, I know a lot of people play Destiny that way. It was never at its strongest that way. So it's strongest when they can give you new stuff and kind of keep it fresh. And I hope Destiny 2 is a platform by which they can do that.
Yeah.
Because they aren't doing anything with Destiny 1 anymore.
No, yeah. I think they also said in that announcement there's going to be some sort of, like, last event or something in Destiny 1. That's like not a paid expansion or something, but just a, yeah, free, like, hey, something's going to be happening. I hope it's a big, cool thing and not just, like, we brought Sparrow Racing back again because nobody liked that the first two times, so yeah, the third time's maybe the shot.
I do think it's funny. I think this is the first time Bungie has officially talked about Destiny 2. I know Activision has, yeah, in sales calls. But I love that Destiny 2 is this thing that's coming out, has never had a formal announcement, but we all know it's coming. Like, yeah, it was the worst kept secret in the industry.
Yeah, and like it is kind of interesting that the first time anything comes out officially from Bungie, it is basically like, hey guys, like, your character shit's going to be different because, yeah, that's how we're making this game. And I understand, like, some people who have, like, put insane numbers of hours into Destiny and, like, done every single thing, gone, like, every single exotic. Like, I get that feeling of, like, oh no, like, that stuff carries over. But it's also, like, by the same token, you know, like, it's something where if you're playing a game like this, you need to accept at some point that your loot grind is more about the journey than it is about the loot thing you get at the end. It's about the fun you've had playing the game with your friends and stuff. It's not the fact that you've got, like, 5 Gjallarhorns or something.
Right.
Because it is just, because whether they do it now or they do it 5 years from now, all that shit that you got in Destiny is going to be completely meaningless to you. So it's, yeah, as someone who used to play World of Warcraft, like, trust me, all that shit just goes away at some point. And it doesn't even matter.
Yeah. And World of Warcraft is a game that's better built to accommodate that.
Yeah, so, yeah. But even then, like, right, you move on from that stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and move on ourselves. I think the best order for this is, I think you should go with Horizon, yeah, Zero Dawn first. And then I think we'll do a little Switch hardware stuff. And then we'll end with Zelda. Because even though I'm going to keep it pretty spoiler-free, I know there are some people who probably aren't going to want to listen to the Zelda discussion if they haven't played it yet. Because so much of it is about how you discover,
yeah,
things.
Yeah, it's discovery.
Yeah. So, like, I'm not going to go in any more depth than I would normally in this kind of discussion, but even that normal amount of depth we give, some people might not want to hear it. So, yeah, anyway, why don't we hear about Horizon Zero Dawn? I have not had a chance to play it because it was coming out 2 days before the Switch, yeah, and that would have been crazy.
I mean, yeah, you already spent, like, fucking $400 or something on Switch in-game and accessories and stuff.
It would be
unreasonable to expect you to then pay $60 and commit the time to play another video game on your PS4.
Yeah, forget the money. It's the time.
Sure.
Like, yeah, because, yeah, I technically bought two of these things because I also bought one for my brother, and I'm basically giving him that as his graduation present because he's graduating from college. So Nintendo got a lot of my money this week.
Yeah, jeez. I'm keeping him afloat.
I am.
On the back of Jonathan Lack. They're like, that motherfucker, if you see this shit, that motherfucker bought two Switches. He's crazy.
I cannot be the only one in that.
No, no, you're not. There are some other insane people, Nintendo people out there.
My favorite, we'll get to Horizon in a second. My favorite thing I've seen online was, I think someone on Reddit had, they bought their like neon Switch, the neon Joy-Cons, blue and red, which is what I got too.
Yeah.
It's nice, colorful and everything. And then they also, just so that they could do this, they bought the separate Joy-Cons where it's like an $80 pack that's also multicolored, but for that they switch the colors so they could have like two red Joy-Cons and two blue ones and like pair them up. And
well, you know, sometimes you wake up in the morning and you're like, I'm a blue Joy-Con kind of feeling today. Like, sometimes you're like, I want red-blue. Sometimes you're like, I want blue-red. Sometimes I want red and gray. Who knows?
It's just, you know, there is literally no reason to have two pairs of Joy-Cons at this point in the Switch's life.
Yeah.
There's no game that requires it, but it just, that made me laugh. Because it's like, it's a silly reason to do it, but at least it's a fun, silly reason.
Sure, you know, whatever brings you Joy-Cons.
That really should be the slogan in their commercials.
That will be in a commercial at some point, I guarantee you. That or something like it.
If they were marketing the Switch like they marketed the Wii U, that would definitely have been in there already.
Yeah, I don't even want to imagine what sort of like train wreck it would be of how you would even manage to fuck up marketing the Switch as bad as you did the Wii U to make it look like it was fucking Wii U accessory.
Oh, my brother and I have already figured this out because whenever we talk about it over text, we always spell it Switch, where the W-I in Switch is now W-I-I.
Is that, it like lowercase s, like uppercase W?
I don't think we usually put that much thought into it, but that's, I think, if you were marketing it, that's what you'd do. Yeah.
Switch.
It would be everything lowercase, but then the W-I-I would be uppercase.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Horizon Zero Dawn.
Horizon Zero Dawn.
Robot dinos.
Robot dinosaurs. Horizon Zero Dawn is a kind of actually a crazy game to sort of try to explain because it does, in kind of like a similar but I suspect opposite way of what Zelda does, it blends a lot of different genres together in such a way that, like, it's kind of hard to describe. Like, it's way more combat focused than because, like, I think when you look at it on the surface, and I think when, you know, you saw demos of it or whatever before it came out, it seemed like, oh, this is like a Ubisoft model sort of open world game that has robot dinosaurs in it. And that was like what it looked like on the front. It's like, maybe it has some Monster Hunter stuff and then that's like will help set it apart in the gameplay. But it seemed like basically it's a Ubisoft style open world game. But when you actually play it, it's like it has that stuff of like the broader structure of the towers and like collectible maps you buy and that kind of stuff. And it does that stuff. It does it way better than any Ubisoft game I've played in years, but it does that kind of stuff. But it also has a really insanely in-depth combat system that has a Monster Hunter-esque thing with the way the enemies are designed, and you can break off pieces of them that will then affect the way that they behave and what sort of actions they can take. And you get parts from them to upgrade your weapons and upgrade your gear. So the combat really has a fascinating sort of push and pull of sort of like hunter and hunted feel to it because it's accentuated for me because I'm playing it on the not the hardest difficulty but the one up from normal, which definitely makes it a bit more brutal because you can die very quickly in this game. Like even like the smallest enemy can just like wipe you out almost immediately, and so if you're not paying attention. And so it has this really dedicated in-depth combat system that borrows from a lot of different places, but it also has this whole like Witcher-esque like RPG thing of like there are like in-depth conversation like dialogue trees in this game where you get to make choices that aren't necessarily like, you know, you're gonna get like three different endings at the end of the game, but choices of like, you know, I'm gonna fucking punch this dude in the face, or I'm going to show sympathy to him, or something like that. You know, you have sort of emotional responses that sort of build up the character of Aloy, your main character. And so it has this really fascinating sort of triple structure of like really intense action, like open action game, like sort of Ubisoft open world exploration-y kind of stuff and crafting like new gear from hunting animals and that kind of stuff. And then it also has a whole light RPG system with a lot of dialogue, really great voice acting, fantastic storytelling and world building, sort of all meshed together. And so it's sort of hard to, I think, break it apart and say like, again, like I said, we're going to talk about a lot of the same stuff we talked about Zelda. It's hard to take this thing and just say it's an open world game and have people understand what that means, because Horizon has just as much in common in like a lot of the gameplay and like story stuff with Mass Effect 2 and 3 as it does with like Assassin's Creed, you know?
It is a weird scenario where, and I think these two games coming out at the same time puts this into stark relief, where open world has kind of ceased to be a recognizable genre,
yeah,
and it's splintered, sort of in the way where, like, I think of, like, you know, we got, like, first-person shooters, and on the outside you can look at, like, a Call of Duty and a Halo and say that's the same thing.
Yeah.
But if you've played those, you know those feel like different genres, practically.
Yeah. And, like, just, even going further with that, you then also have something like Bioshock or, like, Stalker Shadow of Chernobyl on the PC, which is, like, this really intense Russian first-person shooter that's, like, open world and shit. Like, yeah, I think there is a similar thing of, like, there are first-person shooters, but at the end of the day, when you are talking about Bioshock Infinite and you're talking about fucking Doom from 2016, you could not be talking about two more different games on this world, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, like, Breath of the Wild is sort of in the vein of, like, a Skyrim more than, you know, the Ubisoft Rockstar view of open world games, which are two very different things. But then it goes in a totally different place, and Horizon Zero Dawn clearly, like, I haven't played it, but I've seen stuff from it, clearly goes in a totally different place.
Yeah.
Yeah, so these are two big open world games, came out the same week, but they're not the same genre.
Yeah, they're like, they're about as opposite of open world games as you can have, which has made it funny, like, seeing the internet arguments that people are having, because obviously it's wrapped up in this whole console war thing of, like, Nintendo Zelda and Sony Horizon, and looking at it, it's like, one, both of these games can be great. It's not one game, like, they're both great.
It's awesome if they're both
great. It's both, like, just accept that and be happy that everyone, whether, like, you have a Nintendo Switch and a Wii U or you have a PS4, there's a really good game to play on each of those systems. And also, it's, like, so fucking crazy apples and oranges, like, it's really hard, like, kind of in every single aspect. And like, one of the things I think coming into this game that I was really curious about was how it would sort of like carry on the developer's legacy, because this is Guerrilla Games, which has been a Sony developer since the PS2 days where they made Killzone, and so all their games have basically been Killzone games. There's Killzone 1, 2, 3, and then Shadowfall, which was a launch title for the PS4, and I've played all those games except for Killzone 1, because I played, like, because it came with, like, my copy of Killzone 2 I got for the PS3 or whatever, and Killzone 1, I played, like, an hour of it, and maybe that game was okay when it came out, but holy shit, that game does not hold up at all. But Killzone 2 is a really, really good first-person shooter campaign. Killzone 3 is a really good, not quite as good first-person shooter campaign. And Killzone Shadowfall is like half of a really good shooter campaign, half of a terrible shooter campaign, and some really interesting multiplayer, but like definitely suffers from a like launch game sort of... You could tell that if this game had the like proper time and like platform to support it, Shadowfall could have been a much better game. But point being that Guerrilla Games has been tied to the Killzone franchise for so long, and while that franchise has had its like definite high points, and I do think Killzone 2 is a really, really strong first-person shooter campaign and incredibly unique, Guerrilla Games never quite... It always felt like they had this idea of like something they wanted to do, and they never quite made it all the way there with Killzone. That it was just like the story stuff wasn't quite right. Like, they had a cool story they wanted to tell, but they didn't have the world or, like, the sort of people to tell it with. And, you know, they had all these cool mechanics, but they couldn't quite tie it together into, like, a masterpiece first-person shooter campaign. It was always just, like, a really, really good first-person shooter campaign. And so them coming out, like, after Shadowfall, which came out in 2013 with the launch of the PS4, so it's been, like, 4 years now, them coming out with a game like this that is so far away from that is so fascinating, and the fact that they pull it off so well to the point that I look at this game and I think, I hope like the next Assassin's Creed borrows a lot of stuff from this, because of the way that they tell a story in this world, the way that they have the kinds of open world objectives that the Assassin's Creed type game has had, but has them in a sane way, so like there's only 5 towers to climb, there's not like 50, like there's like 5 hunting trial camps that you can go to. There's not 30. Like, you know, there's a decent number of collectibles, but it's like, there's like maybe 50 total collectibles on the map. There's not 500 total collectibles with 70 or like 7 different collectible types the way there was in fucking Assassin's Creed Syndicate. Like, Horizon Zero Dawn is structured in a really sane way and is structured around enabling you to sort of engage with the combat, and is structured around telling your story, and that's the stuff it's most interested in. It's very good at sort of digging away at that. And the number one place that you can see the Guerrilla Games legacy with Horizon is that this game is so fucking gorgeous. It is unbelievable. It's always to their credit, I think, that Guerrilla with Killzone Shadowfall made a game that, because I went back like a day or two before Horizon came out and played the first couple of levels of Shadowfall just to sort of see how it aged it. And I remember that game looking so unbelievably good when I played it when it launched. And I thought, oh, this is going to be like a Perfect Dark Zero thing, where when you went back to Perfect Dark Zero 1 year after that game came out, that game looked like complete shit. That game is so ugly. And so I thought Shadowfall is going to have that. It will be PS4 instead of Xbox 360. And Shadowfall is still a gorgeous looking game because it has not just the great like technical qualifications that Guerrilla has always had. Obviously, like Killzone 2 on the PS3 is still a game that probably looks really fucking good if you go back to it. But they also have this great, unbelievable sense of architecture and art design. And in like Killzone, it was always that sort of architectural, like industrial, kind of oppressive thing they had. And here they have the same sort of beautiful artistic design and everything, but it is built to do this whole post-apocalyptic world where humanity has been wiped out and you have the ruins of civilization all over the place, but you also have nature has reclaimed so much, and it is set in Colorado, and so the beginning, nice. Which is something that people have sort of like pieced together from trailers, but you definitely start in at the beginning a very recognizable sort of like Colorado mountain range area. And then you then move into certain other kind of biomes where you see the effect that how the environment has changed, and that like there are some very arid sections that are not quite what you would see from like going around in Colorado. But I feel like they justify how like why it would look like this like thousands of years or whatever in the future. And so the way they are sort of able to express nature in this game is so gorgeous. It's got that very Witcher-esque like sunset stuff. The lighting system in the game is the best lighting I've seen in any game. Like, the way they have managed to capture silhouettes in like, there's a thing in the game called a cauldron, which are these dungeons you can go around that are, like, these big mechanized factories that are deep under the earth that you go and explore in. And those are obviously very starkly different from the natural landscapes you are in. And the lighting represents that so well. If you have this very harsh, like, kind of, like, you know, binary lighting of either it is bright or it is dark in areas. And there was a part when I was down there where I was just kind of walking around in this tight metal corridor. And as I was walking past these lights, they were flashing on. And the way that looked like it looked like it could have just been a shot from a movie. Because the way how heavy the black was and the way the character was silhouetted against that with this very foggy, voluminous lighting coming in from in front of her while she was moving towards it. It's just, I've never seen a video game capture that kind of lighting that perfectly, and it's all over the place. Like, it doesn't quite have as beautiful sunset and sunrises as Witcher 3 did, but the way this game handles night and the way that moonlight plays off of, like, the machines and it, like, will glint off of them, and the way when you are in the, like, sort of the valleys that have a lot of mist that has settled into the valley over the night, and you see, like, the moonlight, the very sort of beautiful white silver moonlight piercing through the mist is just so spot on and so beautiful, but also has a very distinct artistic touch to it as well, which is, I think, one of the things that has set Guerrilla apart from some other, like from something like a Perfect Dark Zero that means that Shadowfall still holds up or Killzone 2 and 3 still hold up, is because it's not just like grim dark. Like, that's not just what Killzone 2 is, not just like desaturated browns. It is very deliberate in how it uses the color palette it has. In Horizon Zero Dawn, just feels like they were managed to blow that all wide open. And it is, like, I don't know if, like, if you put this right next to Uncharted 4, Uncharted 4 would probably still look a little bit technically better, but that is also a very linear game where it can be designed in such a way to look better. It's like, but Horizon Zero Dawn is definitely, if nothing else, on, like, the technical capacity alone, because it also runs at a, like, rock fucking solid 30 frames per second. I've not seen a single frame drop in the whole game. Like, it is one of the most, if not maybe the most technically impressive sort of graphical games I've ever played. And so that part of the game is just, like, always amazing. But then that aside, I guess, like, let's talk about some of the story and the combat stuff. The story is kind of the most surprising part of the game to me, because I thought that, like, you know, Guerrilla, the story was always the weakest part of the Killzone games, that even though they had an interesting setup to tell an interesting war story, they never did anything good with it. So I was like, nope, there's no way. Like, I always was really intrigued by the setting and the gameplay stuff, but I thought the story would be just kind of like neither here nor there. But they definitely have gone out of their way to, one, they got the guy who was the narrative director on Fallout New Vegas and a couple of other big games, who used to work for Obsidian. He's the narrative director on this game, so they definitely, like, brought in talent from the outside that has a lot of experience telling bigger stories in video games, and, like, really good big stories in video games. And they have managed to make really good on this very unique setting of, like, way post-apocalypse, where humanity has somehow in the past, like, I don't even know what happened yet, humanity collapsed, and it's like sometime a couple of like decades in our future where we were technologically advanced. Obviously, we had robots and stuff, and then something happened. Humanity was like practically wiped out, or at least like civilization as we knew it was completely destroyed. And then thousands of years later, you have all these different groups of sort of tribal societies that are, as far as I know, this whole game takes place in this sort of Colorado area. All these different sort of tribal factions have developed with their own cultures and their own sort of social structures and everything, that worship different things and have different opinions about like whether machines are good or bad or neutral or whatever. And they have constructed a really deliberate, elaborate world that is so fascinating to explore, that has this, that inspires this really sort of scientific curiosity in me. And I made a really dumb tweet like a couple of days ago that if you didn't play the game, you would have no idea what I meant by the stupid joke. And even if you did play the game, you maybe wouldn't know what I meant. But it was a stupid tweet where I said basically Horizon Zero Dawn is an anthropologist's wet dream and a geologist's nightmare. And I should add on to that that it's also an archaeologist's wet dream, because this game is so much about going around and either uncovering these like distant ancient artifacts that are things that we would understand of like, oh, that's a coffee mug. But for these people, like I ran into a really funny character that was talking about, they had this whole theory about, oh, they used all these different sets of these mugs, and they used it in a beard like cleansing ritual, and this held like this gel, and this held the water. And Aloy just looks at him and is like, maybe they just used them to drink out of. He's like, drink out of this beautiful, finely crafted earthenware? You must be insane. It must have been for some sort of sacred ritual, because these people have lost the sort of technology that makes these like incredible mass-produced goods that we understand now. And so there's this whole process of uncovering in an archaeological way these ancient artifacts that are things that we basically understand today, but that these people have to sort of like rediscover and re-understand what they are. And Aloy in particular is a great protagonist, because she has this curiosity for the world that has like disappeared, and then she is ready to embrace it in a way that her tribe sort of is afraid of the ancient world and doesn't want to deal with it, because that's where the machines come from. And she has this intense curiosity to sort of uncover what happened to the world before it. And so it has that sort of archaeological element that I'm getting way more interested in the deeper I get, because the sort of the picture they are very, very vaguely painting of what our world looks like 30 years in the future is so fascinating and sort of like weirdly plausible of how like society is going to go to shit so fast. And I feel like it benefits by us being in a Trump presidency right now, because you can really see this like, yeah, no, I can see we're fucked. You're right. This is all going to end horribly, and we're all going to do something fucking stupid, and this whole like elaborate house of cards we've been is going to collapse.
The twist ending with Horizon is that you find out it was a crazy reality TV show host who somehow got the nuclear codes, and that's what happened to
him. It very well could be. Like it definitely. I've seen some really funny like newspaper clippings that I found from the past. They're not actual newspaper clippings, but it's like digital stuff that you recover, because everything is technological that you sort of uncover in mine. And your character has this thing she calls a focus that is a like ancient, like almost like ancient, like perfect Google Glass or something. Like if you imagine what the Google Glass technology would be like 40 years from now or whatever, and was like really well refined, that allows her to access all this technology in a very intuitive way, so she can sort of like read these archived text entries and stuff that unveil that it's like stupid weird like stuff of the government trying to oppress like free speech on the internet, because they're using the argument that free speech and specifically free assembly does not count for something that is digital, because these people are not technically gathering together in a physical space. It's all in a digital space. So the American government uses that as an excuse to crack down and control communication on the internet.
It's boy, like, is that prescient.
Yeah, like, and it's like, you, I'm constantly uncovering little bits of pieces and stuff like that where I read that and go, oh, holy shit, like, yeah. And it's something where, because it's so slight and it's so suggestive, you just get this small, like, half of a paragraph, and half of it is like weird sort of corrupted data and stuff, so you can't make out all of it. It paints this very evocative sort of broad impressionistic sort of picture of what our future and this world's past looked like. But so that's the archaeological aspect of it. And another part of my favorite part of this game is the anthropological element of going to all these different tribes and seeing how, like, what does humanity look like when it has to rebuild from the ashes? And it's interesting stuff of, like, the tribe that Aloy is from is the Nora, and they have a totally matriarchal system. And so, and it's one of, I think, the strongest bits of world building, because it's so smart, and the way they explain it is so pointed, of that the way you become a matriarch is by being a grandmother. And then the way you become, like, a high matriarch is by being a great-grandmother. And the reason for that is that they say they speak for generations. Because if you have progeny, if you beget progeny that begets progeny, then you speak for two generations of people. And then, obviously, if you go even beyond that, you speak for three generations of people below you. And that's what gives you authority in that society. And that's, like, a really... It's a really good idea that, like, also, like, there are tribes that work on similar systems like that that exist in our world and have existed in the past in our world. But they also, the way they write it and just sort of, like, throw that out there like it's nothing in a way in the dialogue, that it doesn't feel expository. It feels like, no, of course that's just how this world works. And you just, like, kind of say it offhand to this foreigner that doesn't really know how this works. It's really well written.
It is. I feel like... We're starting to really feel the aftershocks of Skyrim, like, 5-6 years yeah. later, of open world games realizing the greatest thing you can do with an open world game is build, like, a civilization that feels yeah. like, and lore and things like that that feel like you're living in it. It's not like, it's not just putting you on a rail or something with
yeah.
that, you know, which even something like a technically an open world game like an Assassin's Creed or something, you can't really go around and explore to that kind of depth yeah. where it feels like a living, breathing world.
And like something like Assassin's Creed, you can't talk to people. And right. like, that's something that's so important to Horizon Zero Dawn, is like, it's not just that they have these interesting tribes, but there are so many, like, basically any named character in the game you can go up to and you can have an in-depth conversation where Aloy will ask them all these different questions and, like, find out, like, oh, like tell me more about you. What is your history? And, like, what do you know about the Karja, who is this whole tribe that has a, like, much more sort of elaborate kind of culture. They're not culture, but, like, civilization built up around this whole sort of abandoned structure that they have built into and have, like, really developed, like elaborate art and stuff like that in there, where, like, people live in big stone homes and stuff, which is very different from the Nora that all live in, like, you know, they're more sort of nomadic in some ways, and they live on the move, and they don't keep these big elaborate possessions because they think that that sort of devalues you as a person if you have all this just material stuff that you've amassed. And so you can have all that set building, but it doesn't matter if you can't talk to the people that live in those sets about them and, like, about their life and about the world they live in. And that's how they flesh out the story, is it's just straight up, like, a Mass Effect style, like, dialogue wheel where you can just ask everyone, like, all these different questions. And then another amazing touch to that is that even if it's not a named person, you can't have a conversation with them, but you can say hello. And it reminds me of, like, kind of like Gravity Rush 2, where you have gestures that you can do, where you can, like, wave to people in the world, and Gravity Rush 2, they will wave back. In Horizon, you don't have a whole set of gestures, but any random other human in the world, that as long as they're not, like, a bandit that is trying to kill you, you can walk up to them, you can press triangle, and you can say hello, and they'll be, hello, Nora, lady, like, hi, what's up? And they will respond to you in some way. Some of them will be, like, standoffish and aggressive. Some of them will be like, oh, I heard about you. You're the seeker from the Nora tribe. And that's such a small touch that, to me, is so important at building out the sense of, like, there are people that live in this world, and the people who live in this world are important, and they are part of different social structures and cultures that feel fleshed out and developed, like, in places that you do see and become very informed about, but it also is suggestive of a larger culture that you don't necessarily even have a window into. Because even with the Nora, Aloy is an outsider because she was born as an outcast, because basically they don't know who her mother was, and she was just sort of found as a child. and that means in a matriarchal society, if you are motherless, they don't want anything to do with you, and so they basically cast her out of the tribe, and she's raised by another outcast. And so that gives a very good way for one to justify why Aloy is so, I think, curious about the old world, is because she is so detached from the world she lives in and the cultures in the world she lives in the present. But it also gives her a very good reason to sort of be curious about this society she goes into and asks all the questions she has and feels justified that she doesn't necessarily know as much as some other people do in the world. And it's very smart at the way they sort of exposit a lot of that stuff. But going back to my stupid tweet, you know, I think they do the anthropology stuff, the archaeology stuff really well. The one place where, in a totally scientific way, they drop the ball, in an aesthetic way, I think it's actually really cool and well done, but it's just really funny. It's basically one of the first things that happens in the game is Aloy falls, as a child, falls into an ancient ruin, which is basically like an office building or something that is like under, like sunk under the ground, and like everything has grown over it. And so she falls down there and is exploring it. That's where she finds the focus, like Google Glass kind of thing. And while she's down there, I was looking at it, and I was like, there's something weird about this. And I realized the cave is covered with stalactites and stalagmites, which is like, it's a really cool look because it's a very comprehensive way of sort of representing, one, the ways in which, like, our human civilization and society that we like to think as being so detached from nature and, like, the animal kingdom and trees and all that stuff is, like, a part of that and will be absorbed by that and used by that in a very Last of Us kind of way. And it's a very stark, great-looking, like, visual of you are in this, like, again, an office building looking sort of area where you see like desks and office chairs and stuff that have degraded and grown over and like petrified and stuff. And then you look up in the ceiling and there's just these big stalactites hanging down. It's like, that's a really cool look. And I've never quite seen another thing, like post-apocalyptic thing, that has gone that far with it. But there's maybe a good reason why a post-apocalyptic thing has not gone that far with it, because it is absolutely absurd given the time scale they give you that stalactites and stalagmites would have formed after our civilization has gone away, because it would have literally taken like tens of millions of years, because stalactites are formed by basically like moisture forming and like grabbing fucking molecules of calcium and shit and bring it and forming it in one spot where it drips and then lands on the ground and deposits some of that calcium there, and slowly over the course of like millions of years it builds up into like rock. And so I was like looking at that, I'm like, yeah, that's, it looks really good, but it's fucking ridiculous that it would be like that.
There's a reason why if you ever see a stalactite in person, it's on like a nature walk in a cave behind like a gate where you can't get to it because stupid people shouldn't touch it.
Yeah, because that thing is older than the human species itself, and it's like, and it is also something where, if you do this all the time in video games where you break stalactites and stalagmites, like I did that to kill a fucker in Hitman like a month before I started playing Horizon Zero Dawn, I usually don't think anything of it, but there was something about, and this is kind of a pro tip, that when you grow up and become big Aloy, you can go back to where that thing is, to where that cave is, and re-explore it as an adult, and there's some areas you can go into that you couldn't when you were a child because you have your spear, and you can just like break these stalactites and stalagmites that are blocking some doorways. And it was like, I actually had some weirdly conflicted feelings about that, because I think it's something where the game inspires this sense of, again, like archaeology of you uncovering this civilization. And I was like, oh god, I can't, even if it's like logically impossible that these things could ever have formed in this way, and it's obviously a fucking video game, I felt this weird regret of smashing these things. It's like, no, do you have any idea how hard that moisture and calcium had to work over the course of unfathomable eons to build this fucking thing up, and you're just gonna walk up with your stupid fucking like metal spear and smash it? That's irresponsible. That's just gross. You can't do that. You should be standing up a fucking nature preserve, Aloy. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like that stuff in the game is, again, even if that's like obviously scientifically absurd, it is, again, a really great aesthetic, and that's what actually matters. Like, I'm sure, obviously, the environmental artists probably know way more about fucking stalactites and stalagmites than I do, because they draw them all the time that they're working on these kinds of games. So I'm sure they were aware of the scientific inconsistencies and didn't give a fuck because it looked fucking awesome.
Yeah, that's like, you gotta break the rules. If you made a real archaeology game that was like super true to life,
yeah,
it would be the most boring game ever made.
Exactly, yeah. You'd have a whole mechanic over just like swiping a bit of dust off of a thing, and you have to like so slowly, delicately maneuver the analog stick, because if you jerked it too much, you'd just like break this pot and be like, oh nope, you failed. Not only did you fail the mission, like this guy, like depending on how old and precious this thing was, you might be arrested by like the Egyptian government or something. Like,
who can forget the Wii classic Wii Archaeology, where you had to waggle the Wiimote just a little bit to like dust off this pot.
And it was completely impossible to play because the Wiimote was not sensitive enough to be able to pick up the slow movement, so you had to move it so quickly that when the game registered it, it was so quick that you broke whatever you were doing, but if you moved any slower, the Wiimote couldn't even pick it up.
Yeah, it was a real... The recall of that game was sad.
Yeah, it was. I'm really looking forward to Switch Archaeology, and I think they'll manage to get it this time.
I think that HD rumble is going to help.
Yes, the HD rumble. It's, you know, ancient Chinese pottery rumbles all the time. I think we all know that. Anyways, back to Horizon Zero Dawn. I've talked a lot about this game, and somehow I haven't even really talked about the thing that everyone knows about this game, and that there are big, awesome fucking robot dinosaurs in it. So I think that will be the sort of thing I close out on, is the combat stuff and the robot dinosaurs. And it's something that... This is the part of the game that took a long time for it to click for me, because I think the combat, the pace of the combat, and the sort of the weapons you have and stuff, it's very different. I haven't played a game that with a combat system that quite feels like this, that quite has this balance of... Again, like there's a lot of setting traps and sort of trying to plan things out and making advantage of your environment and like stealthing it around. But inevitably, the machines are generally so powerful that it's like if you're doing a big fight against a machine, something is going to go wrong. I have not had a perfect planned orchestrated series of events where I have like come out completely unscathed from a huge fight yet. Though I think like maybe that is in my future if I'm good enough at this game. But the pacing is very distinctive in how the combat is laid out, and it took me a long time to sort of get a feel for that. And so for a while I just wasn't super into the combat, and it wasn't until I got into a fight with two sawtooths that are basically big saber-toothed tiger looking things that is part of a side quest that you end up in this fight with two of them at the same time. And I had only ever fought one of them like individually and even away from like any smaller enemies, and so I was really intimidated by this, and I died like three or four times in this fight because I was like, I just don't know, I can't get this, I can't do it well. And then I was just looking at all the tools I had, and then also I realized there's a sort of a glossary thing you have in your menu that has a bunch of different things in it, of like all the audio logs or like text archives and stuff you picked up, but it also has a record of all the like 20 or something different enemy, like robot enemy types that are in the game, and it will has broken out all the sort of bits of loot you can get from them, because they all have unique like sawtooth cores and stuff like that you use to build or trade for better gear later in the game. But it also has a list of all the different weak points and how to attack them and what effect they have. And so it's stuff with like the sawtooth. I realized, oh, they have this canister basically on their belly of what they call blaze, which is basically probably like oil or something, that when you shoot it with fire arrows, it will explode. And so then I realized, okay, so if I hit that, like with this fire arrow, that thing will explode. But how do I sort of get at that thing? And I came up with a strategy that was like, okay, I have this rope caster that is something that you've seen probably in some of the trailers, of where you can shoot it at an enemy and it will sort of like drag a stake and rope attached to the enemy into the ground. And if you hit enough of them with that, they'll basically collapse to the ground sort of exposed. And so I was like, okay, that will expose that canister on their bottom that will allow me to hit it in a very easy way. But then also I need to make sure that the other sawtooth is preoccupied with something. So I came up with a whole elaborate strategy of where I had a electric tripwire that I put up between two trees, that then I lured one of the sawtooth and had them chase me and like slid under this tripwire, and they would hit it with, and the electric tripwire would go off and stun that sawtooth while I ran over and used the rope caster to pin the other sawtooth down. And I had it where I pinned him just close enough to the first one that was stunned, that when I pinned him down and I could see his canister and I hit it with the flame arrow, the explosion was big enough that it hit both of the sawtooths, or however you fucking pluralize those, and took out both of like half of their health instantaneously for both of them. And that was like this moment where I realized, oh, that's how the combat in this game works in these sort of big scenarios, is you look at what you're fighting against, you look at the area you're in and like what sort of choke points and stuff there are, then you, and you look at your glossary and see, okay, like, okay, these things have a freeze thing here, like, that's like, if I pull away this piece of its armor with like a tear arrow, then I can get at this freeze thing, and if I hit that with an arrow, like, that will cause it to sort of freeze and be stunned for a little bit and stuff like that. Or like, oh, if I hit this part of it, that means it won't be able to use its ranged attack anymore because that's its battery or something. Or if I hit its leg, it'll limp and won't be able to charge at me. And so you sort of get together all of your sort of facts of like, okay, this is how you tackle these kinds of different robot enemies. And at this point in the game, I haven't seen all the different types of robots there are in the game yet. And so you get all that stuff together. And then you look at your set of weapons, because you have like 8 or 9 types of weapons you can use that all have, as you upgrade them, different ammo types they can get. So like your normal bow has like normal arrows, then flame arrows, and then basically arrows that are better at tearing away enemies' armor. And so, and all the different weapons have basically 3 different ammo types they get as you level them up. And so you just look at all that shit you have access to and just come up with a plan of how do I approach this scenario, these enemies with these tools I have access to, and then try to execute on that plan. And it has this very deliberate, in some ways almost Hitman-esque element to it of trying to take stock of your whole situation and coming up with a plan and then executing on it. And it's not about running in gung-ho and just shooting arrows at stuff. It's not about doing these combat encounters completely on the fly. It is very much about this sort of hunter fantasy, only you're going against these giant robot enemies that provide great opportunities for, again, like structural weak points that then have very clear effects that allow you to make very clear strategies against them of this type of damage is good against this enemy on this part of them that will then cause them to do less damage that will then make it easier for me to attack this other type of enemy with this type of arrow. And so it is a very elaborate series of mechanics and systems built around weaknesses and manipulating the enemies in different ways and damaging them in different ways to give you an advantage in battle. And it's just something that the deeper and deeper I've gotten into the game, the deeper and deeper I feel like the combat system has. And it's opened up so much to me at this point in the game where I have like one fight against a enemy that is this like big giant, it's the biggest robot I've seen so far, that kind of is this giant mole thing that digs under the ground. And I was able to, the first time I fought it, have this really intense fight where I used up basically all my health potions I had, but was able to defeat it by taking advantage of that stuff and being able to like take out its claws so it couldn't dig under the ground anymore, and take advantage of, like, I think it had a shock weakness or something, and just sort of shock it and pause it and sort of stop it for long enough where I could go in for critical hits with my spear. And it's a very satisfying combat loop that feels like it has a lot of depth to it and is very unique. And I'm really looking forward to getting to like the end of the game and seeing sort of what big elaborate combat scenarios they can come up with that has all these different... Because again, there's like, when you look at that glossary, something like 20 different robot types like overall. And that's a really insane number of enemies that have like this kind of like really in-depth like AI patterns and different attack designs and stuff like that. The combat system in this game is really something special, I think.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's a whole lot about Horizon Zero Dawn. It is a game that, again, I haven't had as much time to play as I would have liked, so I'm not necessarily right at the beginning of the game. I'm maybe like halfway through, but I've wanted to play it a lot more than I've had time to. But I'm really excited to get back in, especially I want to see where the story ends up going, because I suspect it's going to get like really good at, like, I feel like I'm right on the precipice of a couple of like big reveals that are going to sort of like kick the story into high gear for like a second or a third act kind of thing.
Yeah, it is such a fascinating thing. You know, you talk about Guerrilla Games.
Yeah.
You know, they made these Killzone games, and now they get to do this. I cannot think of a good analog for that.
Yeah.
Because like, even if you think of other, you know, developers who have been around long enough to do multiple franchises and B, have wanted to do multiple franchises.
Yeah.
You have things like Rockstar doing Grand Theft Auto and then making Red Dead. And Red Dead is a different setting, but it's very similar gameplay mechanics.
Yeah, it has, you know, like the letter M on the map where you go to talk to the dude whose name that starts with M to get the mission, you know.
Right.
It is a Grand Theft Auto kind of game.
Or Naughty Dog going from Uncharted to The Last of Us, which is a huge tonal departure, but gameplay-wise, they are clear siblings.
Yeah, know? I mean, Naughty Dog has, ever since like Crash Bandicoot, only made third-person games with platforming elements. Like,
right.
And then as it's gone on, they've added more and more shooting to it, you know, through, yeah, like the Jak and Daxter days.
To completely abandon like the genre that you've been living in for that long and go in a different direction and find this new sense of identity is a fascinating case study.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to play the game. I'm not sure. I have no idea when I'll be able to.
Yeah.
Sometime this year I would like to. It seems really cool. So.
Yeah. No, because it is... It's something where it feels like if you woke up the next, like, tomorrow, and all of a sudden, like, Naughty Dog was making an MMORPG. And it's like, fucking what? Like,
it'll probably be good, but that's weird.
Because it's especially just so impressive that Guerrilla has literally never made a game anything like this at all. Like, there are a couple of levels in Killzone Shadowfall early on that are a bit more open that, like, when I played that game a little bit before going into Horizon, I could kind of see, like, oh, maybe some of the, like, the people in Guerrilla that were fighting for these kinds of the really good levels early on in Killzone Shadowfall, it feels like those people won and got to make Horizon Zero Dawn and sort of, like, guide the studio to that, because those levels are, like, big and open and have a lot of trees and foliage and make use of different interesting stealth encounters and designs and stuff that the rest of that game never, like, did anything with. It feels like you can kind of see the kernels of Horizon Zero Dawn a little bit in, like, the second mission in Killzone Shadowfall. But in general, I can't really think of another studio that has done this to go on to, like, make a game in a completely, utterly different genre. And then also just to do that genre incredibly well in a way that's, like, again, I want the people, like, making the Assassin's Creed Egypt game or whatever. Like, obviously, that game is deep into development, but I hope if they're not necessarily can't implement specifically ideas from Horizon Zero Dawn, that they are thinking about the same things and are on a similar track, because I think there's a lot of ideas about how to tell a story in this kind of open world structure, and also how to sort of have a sense of sort of restraint with the kinds of, with how much you offer in this sort of open world structure that a lot of those games could really learn from Horizon.
Nice. All right, so let's go ahead and move on and talk about the Nintendo Switch.
Yes, let's switch it up, Jonathan.
If we had a Nintendo executive here with us, they would do the snap.
Yeah.
They'd be really into it. It'd
be a whole thing.
Yeah. All right, so the Nintendo Switch, man, I was excited for the launch of this thing because it felt like, even though, weirdly, like, it only being, like, 6 weeks from the big unveiling to the launch, that made it feel longer in weird ways because it was, like, such a compressed time period to be excited for something. And they also revealed so little before it came out. And then the week leading up, of course, the journalists had it, and I was so curious to try my hand at this thing and got it in Friday. And I really, really like the Nintendo Switch. It is not without flaws.
Sure, yeah.
No launch hardware is. I don't feel like there is anything in here that bothers me to the degree that, you know, I'm pessimistic about any part of its future. I think my overall conclusion after a couple days using this thing is Nintendo has a really, really solid foundation for a new generation, and it is up to them to follow through on that,
right,
and to have the games, you know, first party and third. And I don't necessarily mean like they have to bring over the next Call of Duty. I don't need that or want that here. I don't think that's what this thing is built for. But getting indies and other kinds of games and just, you know, supporting this well, getting the online infrastructure up, virtual console stuff, a lot of that stuff that's not there at launch and is a little disappointing. But what is there is a really, really solid foundation. I wouldn't necessarily, you know, recommend right off the bat that everyone who's a Nintendo fan or is interested in this needs to go out and buy it right now.
Yeah.
Because it's not, you know, and that's true of 99% of launch hardware, is you don't really need it day one unless you're an enthusiast. But I could confidently say if you are on that sort of enthusiast streak and you want it just to be there and kind of follow the progression, I think it's a really solid foundation. So kind of backing up from the macro to the micro, specifically the micro, because the first thing I noticed when I got this thing in and opened it up is the Nintendo Switch is surreally small. Like, not in the, to the degree where it's like a Game Boy Micro or something.
But
just for something that is ostensibly a home console and can be used as a home console, this thing is tiny. I mean, you just saw it. We were playing with it before we went on air. And you get that, you know, you open the box and you have some vision of what this might look like. But then you pull it out and the tablet part on its own is pretty small. It's a 6.2-inch screen. There's a little bit of a bezel around it, and it's, you know, it's thicker than like an iPad or something, but it's not hugely thick. I would compare it maybe to the original Vita model, kind of in that range.
Sure, yeah, around
maybe
there.
A little thicker, but you know, around there. And so you look at that and you're like, wow, and you kind of, it hits you that this is the thing. Like, there's all these accessories. There's the Joy-Con, there's the dock, there's the adapter and all that stuff. But the actual like brains of this thing are all in this little system. And to me, seeing that started putting things in perspective to me. Because I think there's been a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of clickbait out there about the Switch. There's been a lot of articles and a lot of journalists talking about this in different ways to, with varying degrees of positivity or negativity or whatever. And to me, it kind of comes down to the fact that this system is trying to be a jack of all trades. It probably does wind up being that master of none kind of thing where it is not necessarily the best at any of the things it does. But it also doesn't necessarily need to be, because what it is trying to do is so massively different than anything we've had before, to the degree where I look at, you know, quote-unquote flaws like the battery life when you're playing handheld is not all that long, and what I'm thinking of is, yeah, but that was also true, like, of the Game Boy back in the day. Like, the very first, you know, you'd get four fucking double A's in that thing, yeah. And it didn't last as long as,
load,
like,
that thing up like a fucking shotgun.
Load it up like a fucking shotgun. And there's a lot of things we would probably go back and say feel very awkward about the first Game Boy, especially in comparison to later models and stuff. But no one had ever done something like that before.
Sure,
and yeah. I think we're in that place with the Switch where whatever shortcomings it has, it's because it's trying something really new, and not new in a way where, like, it's the Wii U and it looks stupid and gimmicky. New in a way that I find genuinely exciting. So, no, when you dock this thing, it's not going to have the power of a PS4. But when you actually hold it and get perspective on that, you're like, well, of course, this thing is tiny. That it can run a game like Breath of the Wild, period, is a pretty impressive feat of engineering. And that it only has, like, one vent, but doesn't get all that hot and doesn't get all that loud and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, that is really impressive. And that you can literally do what is the name of the console, and you can switch and put it in your dock, play it like a home console, and it feels very seamless that way. Take it out, use it like a handheld, and it works great that way too. And again, not perfect in any configuration necessarily, but very compelling on that level, you know. And it is just, it is a surreal thing where I, you know, to do all the setup and stuff, I just left it in handheld mode, and then it was like time to dock it, and I put it in, and what I had showed up on the TV, and you can kind of hear about that and look at the videos all day long, but actually doing that yourself is a very surreal experience, because again, there's never been anything that does that like that. The closest is stuff that like streams to your TV,
yeah.
Like taking your iPhone and putting it on an Apple TV, or the Vita, you know, streaming the PS4. That's just a very different thing. It's not literally, I am taking the brains of this console out, or yeah. I'm putting the brains of this console in. And it's just weird. Like, I, you know, I put it in to start Breath of the Wild because I wanted to start, you know, playing that on the TV with the big screen and everything. And I just kept having to kind of look over at the Switch dock, which is also just really small. Like, I had kind of made more space for it than it needed in my entertainment center. And I was kind of surprised by how little of a footprint it made just sitting there. And I kind of had to, you know, I'm playing this big, amazing, beautiful game. And I would kind of look over and I'm like, this is running off this little tablet in this thing. Like, that's amazing. That's a really cool trick that Nintendo has pulled there. And that it is totally seamless. Like, if you pull it out, it goes onto the screen on the handheld instantaneously. And when you put it back in, the only reason it doesn't show up on your TV instantaneously
is because it has a handshake with the HDMI.
Yeah. And it goes as fast as, like, it possibly could. And just other things that are so neat about it, that because it is kind of, the brains are in a handheld, in a tablet form, it is much faster than any other console at the moment. Like, its UI is pretty bare bones right now, but it's really fast. It's really snappy. Like, you know, the Xbox One we know is a slow piece of shit.
Yeah.
The PS4 has a really nice UI, but it has at least, it's always had a little bit of slowness at some times. And recently, I don't know, I know they're kind of looking to fix this with the next update, but it's had a little bit where it's feeling a little laggy. There's none of that on the Nintendo Switch. It moves just super fast. It's super responsive. I showed you the screenshot feature earlier. Yeah. The moment you press the screenshot button, your capture is taken. It's completely instantaneous. There's none of that lag where you're wondering, did it get it? Did it get the right thing? Did it, you know, whatever. It's a right. really nice use of that. You can zip around really fast. All of that is nice. And there's things like sleep mode where when this thing goes into sleep mode, it just turns off like a handheld, like the Vita or like the 3DS, and then you put it back on. And even if you have it in docked mode, You press home and you're waking it up, it's awake instantaneously and you can play Zelda immediately if you had it in a suspended state, to the degree where it's a little disconcerting where if I have it docked and I want to come back to play Zelda, it takes longer for my TV and like receiver to turn on than the Switch itself.
Right.
And that's a really weird, interesting thing, but it's like a compelling part of the hardware. So on a, you know, power level and some of those things, you are making some sacrifices. This thing is not, it couldn't run Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, it's something like that. And so it's not going to be competing in that same lane. But I've already, you know, started to think that, I think that conception that we've had from generations past of, you know, you have like two or three consoles and they all can play the same stuff and they have some exclusives, I think that's an outdated idea. I think we've kind of seen that by now, certainly of the PS4 and the Xbox One. I think most people don't have room in their life for both of those at this point, and it's part of why the PS4 has just been wiping the fucking floor with the Xbox One in terms of sales. And, you know, the Xbox One needs to distinguish itself from being that other box where you can play the same games in slightly lower quality, and there's also a Halo game that isn't that good. That's kind of like, there's kind of a, and I know I'm exaggerating.
I think the Xbox One is the console you want to buy if you want to play a racing game, because this is the only console that has a fucking racing game on it right now.
Yeah, the Forza series.
Unless you want to go all the way back and play Drive Club from like 2014,
yeah,
you're going to fucking have to buy an Xbox One if you want to play a racing game on a console.
No, plenty of great games on Xbox One, but it is definitely the one that I think certainly from a consumer perspective, from a gamer perspective, it has not really distinguished itself in a lot of ways. And so I'm okay with consoles doing kind of radically different things. And a lot of this is going to come down to what is supported on the Switch in the future and what kind of games Nintendo manages to make for it, what kind of games other people manage to make for it. But, you know, even if, you know, it's running, you know, what is less powerful for a console, it's really powerful for a handheld. So in handheld mode, this is the most advanced portable system there's ever been.
Yeah.
By a long shot. And that you can then plug it in and play these games that, you know, Zelda, as much as any game, feels like a full home console experience, and there's no disconnect there. And that's a really interesting thing. Like, I actually think in so many ways you could not ask for a better launch game for this thing than Zelda Breath of the Wild, because it's, you know, it's pushing that technology to its limit. It feels like something brand new from Nintendo at a time when they're trying to do something brand new on a console side. It is a game that is very compelling to have on your TV and all that, but it's also fun to play in small bursts when you have it on the go, and it definitely shows off that portable screen. It, you know, works well with the Joy-Con controllers and the Pro controllers. It's sort of this game that is sort of the perfect thing to introduce and roll out that system with, I think, because of all those things, and say, hey, look, Breath of the Wild, it does not have the kind of visual, I don't know, depth of something like a Horizon Zero Dawn where they can go crazy with the lighting systems and all that. But you would be lying if you looked at it and said, you know, that's not one of the most beautiful games I've ever looked at. It is absolutely one of the most beautiful games ever made. And Nintendo can really kind of throw the gauntlet down with that and say, we're running this thing off like a heavily modified mobile chip, but we can do something like that. And this is day one. We're going to get further than that. And I think that's compelling. So just that basics of it, I really love. I like the UI right now a lot. There are things they need to add to it, obviously. The online infrastructure is very bare bones at the moment. You can go into the eShop. You can play multiplayer games online, and you can add friends and stuff, but I don't think there's even a native chat client at the moment.
No, there's no messaging system on it at all, from what I've read.
Yeah, which is, and again, it's kind of hard to judge that because there's no game that requires it yet.
Yeah.
Really. But, you know, once something like, once Mario Kart 8, for instance, comes out on this thing, you would hope a lot of that is up and running, because that does have a pretty robust online mode.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to think of, like, I think that's the first game that will really test that. So hopefully they'll have that ready by then.
Yeah,
we'll see. You know, but it's very smooth, like, signing up. It's definitely the easiest setup I've ever had for a Nintendo system that has, like, a UI. Not, the Game Boy Advance was really easy to set up.
I was setting the Game Boy Advance SP up just the other day.
Yeah.
Man, press that whole fucking power switch. Yeah, I just kind of wish it understood intuitively when I wanted it to turn on, because pressing the power switch is a bit much. I don't know.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it is pretty cool that with the Switch, it's got this fast UI. You get in there, you're signed up immediately. You know, do a little day one update if you want. You don't really even have to, unless you want to buy games from the eShop and stuff. And then you can pop Zelda Breath of the Wild in, and you just play it. And it's like, oh man, it's been a while since I was able to do that with something that is sort of a home console. You know, you just can't do that these days. The PS4, I remember, it was a couple hours before I was actively able to play something, I think. So, I played Killzone Shadowfall a little bit, but there were some issues with the servers day one and stuff that held that back. But, you know, so all of that is cool. In terms of, you know, playing the system itself, the main, you know, control you get with it is the Joy-Cons. And they're these two, you know, little controllers. They snap onto either side of the screen. You can take them off, hold them individually, put them in the Joy-Con grip. You can also use the, like, little wrist straps they give you with them. So there's a lot of different ways to use them. And I really, really love the Joy-Cons. I think they are obviously going to be divisive because they are a non-traditional control technique. But I think it's pretty cool that Nintendo has managed to get a full console control setup onto those things. So if you're playing in handheld mode, you have every button you would need. It's got two analog sticks, they both press in. It's got four face buttons on either side. You know, the only thing it doesn't have technically is a real D-pad, because it has to mirror those things.
Yeah.
So far, that hasn't been a problem. I want to play Shovel Knight, which is one of the games they have on there, because I want to kind of see how that feels with that sort of thing. But it's all on there. I think they're very comfortable to use. Your first thought when you see them is that, just as with the console, it's like, those are really small. But, you know, I just held them loose, one in each hand, to start Breath of the Wild, and I immediately took to them. Like, they formed to my hands, and I have big hands, they formed my hands really well. They're very comfortable for long play sessions. They have an incredible battery life. Like, yesterday, as I said, I played Zelda for a ridiculous amount of time, and, like, the little battery indicator barely went down. It's nuts. Like, especially because, you know, like, the PS4 controller doesn't have very good battery life. The Xbox One controller has okay battery life. When the fucking controller will charge? Go back to last week if you want to hear that rant. But these are, like, the real deal in terms of long battery life, which Nintendo controllers have typically had in the last couple generations, which is nice. So, but I find them very comfortable. Like, I am someone who always liked the Wiimote and Nunchuck setup. Not necessarily inherently like I loved both controller, but I kind of liked the feeling of I had the Wiimote in one hand, the Nunchuck in the other, and I didn't have to hold it the way I would, you know, hold a normal controller, and that kind of, it's always kind of the same feeling. I kind of like being able to have my arms loose or in different configurations. And with the Joy-Cons, it's that, you know, to the nth degree, because they are...
Untethered.
They're completely wireless. They're smaller. You know, they take a little bit of getting used to, but I really am surprised by how fast I got used to them. And I have played a ton of Zelda, my hands have not gotten fatigued, and I have played mostly just untethered with nothing on them, and I've really, really enjoyed that. I've put them in the grip a couple of times just to kind of test that and feel how it feels. I think it's really nice. I think some people are going to like that more. Like, for instance, the way you hold a controller is to have the...
R1 and L1 with my four fingers, and R2 and L2 with my middle fingers.
Right, so you can press both of them at once.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do if you're holding the Joy-Cons loose or even
I would say it's impossible. Who just tried to do that, you cannot do that. That is not reasonable.
Yeah, you really can't do that. If you put them into the grip, I tried it a little bit, and I think you could do that. It wouldn't be the most natural thing in the world, but it is possible to do. So, you know, that is an alternate control scheme. The grip is light and feels good. It's obviously not going to be a replacement if you want something like a full-featured DualShock or Xbox One gamepad, something like that. The Joy-Cons are not going to necessarily give you that thing, but I think if you are okay with these kind of different controller configurations, it's fine. Now, Breath of the Wild is a challenging game, and it uses lots of different controls, but it's also fairly laid back. It's not, like, twitchy in the way some games would be.
Yeah.
And so it's a fairly relaxed test for this. I did notice when I played Fast RMX, my hands felt a little bit cramped because racing games, you know, like, require you to hold one button down and things like that. And so I think it'll depend on the type of game, what the Joy-Cons feel best for. For Zelda, they feel absolutely perfect to me, like, to the degree where I have a Pro Controller on order. It's coming in tomorrow. But if I had gotten to use the Joy-Cons ahead of time, I probably wouldn't have ordered one yet. I'm totally fine playing this with just the loose Joy-Cons. So it'll be nice to have an extra control method, but...
Yeah, for me, like, and obviously this is, I only used them a little bit, like for like 10 minutes or something, and I didn't love the feeling of the Joy-Cons. Like, they felt a bit too small. In particular, I found, like, it helped a lot more when I stopped trying to hold the controllers in the more natural way for me, but I still found, like, it felt weird trying to get leverage to push the control sticks, if you know what I mean? In a way that, like, I see what you're saying with, like, Zelda, it's not a big deal. I could see if, like, you were trying to play... this is a weird example because it would never be on the console, but like Doom, like a fast, like first person shooter where you're trying to manipulate the control sticks very quickly. I think like you don't have enough leverage just holding those things sort of free in your hands to do that very quickly and like accurately.
I agree. Like that's probably the biggest weakness is if you had to press in on the control sticks,
yeah.
Which you don't have to do a lot in Zelda anyway. That would be probably a bigger difficulty. And yeah, you know, there are going to be things that those controllers aren't perfect for, but it's another one of those things where like, if they wanted to make the console they made, I'm not sure what else they could have done with those to have this control technique that you can snap onto the console and it's like a handheld, but you still got all your, you know, controls, and then you can pull them off and use them that way. You know, the best remedy would be to something like just have the Pro Controller in every box as a bundle.
Yeah.
And we could argue whether or not they should have done that.
Maybe at the very least they could have not made it $70.
Sure, that is undeniable probably. But yeah, so... But, you know, for a starter for what there is on the console now, I like them a lot. And you and I just did some two-player stuff where, you know, one of the things that's also notable about the Joy-Cons is that if you're in a pinch and you just want to say, I don't have an extra controller, but I got these two Joy-Cons, and you want to play like a racing game, we played some fast RMX this way, split screen, and then we played some Snipper Clips, the demo of it.
Yeah.
And I kind of, you know, like, again, I wouldn't want to play like for hours that way or anything, but if you're just like, this is what I have on me and we can use those, it's kind of a cool thing to just be able to say, here, you take this one.
It's a neat party trick. I did think because I had the red Joy-Con and that one, the joystick is in the middle. That's a little bit
weird,
awkward feeling, because it's like you just got like half of the controller. It's just complete dead space, and it's like you have to put your thumb in the middle. Like, it's not a big deal because the controller is so small, but it's like it feels like your thumbs are really cramped because they're all in the right half of the controller. But yeah, like it is a cool thing. I would definitely not want to play a game for longer than like 15 minutes or something that way. But like for a quick little thing, and be like, hey, let's do like two, like while we're like on this basketball court, let's play a match of NBA 2K17 or whatever, you know, fucking weird circumstances they have. I think it is a suitable controller for something like that.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's a neat, I really thought it was cool. Like, tonight, I brought my Switch over. I love that I can just bring the whole console with me, basically. And I set it up here with the flimsy kickstand, which is fine if you put it on a table and don't touch it.
There was a moment where you went to change the volume and you pressed it. It looked like the Switch was just going to collapse into our table.
Yes, it was a little, yeah, the build quality on this thing, and you probably saw this too, is really good.
No, yeah, it's a very slick piece of kit, for sure.
Except for that fucking kickstand, for whatever reason. And look, no console's perfect, but that's a weird thing. Like,
I mean, no other console has a kickstand, so that's true. You know, there's nothing really to compare it with. It's like, you know, not everything can be as great a first idea and execution as the handle on the GameCube.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, there's no handle on the Switch. It's too bad. No, but, you know, we put it there, and we just had a screen. Really beautiful, nice screen there. And then we were playing a racing game split screen. Not ideal, because, like, you weren't quite familiar with it yet.
I mean, also, like, the screen is pretty small if you're putting it up on a table from, like, a certain distance from you for two people to look at it. And, like, it is really magnified by having it be split screen. Like, again, that's a situation where, like, it was fun to play in this setting. Like, I would never want to play that game for much longer than that. Like, with that sort of screen, like, because, like, you know, the screen is works really good when you're holding it up to your face like a normal handheld controller. Propping it up on the table, it's like, especially for, like, anything that's more complex than Snipper Clips, it felt a bit cumbersome.
But I was going to get to Snipper Clips. That was really fun. And I just, that was a case where it all kind of disappeared. I wasn't thinking about the Joy-Con or the screen. You just kind of get into it. And I can totally see Nintendo and some of the indie developers they work with having a lot of fun with things like that.
Yeah.
If day one you can have something like Snipper Clips, which is a really neat idea and very well executed and kind of perfect to show off that hardware, then I think the sky's the limit with some of that stuff.
Yeah. For me, definitely when we were playing Snipper Clips, I wasn't really thinking about the controls. I was just thinking about how you couldn't fucking pop that fucking balloon and you kept on knocking it away, and then I had to jump up and hook the fucking balloon.
Snipper Clips is cool. There's a free demo in the eShop, which is awesome because that's a game, like, you have to play to kind of get it.
Yeah, that is definitely a really cool two-player co-op kind of game. I know that it goes up to four players for some modes. I think, like, the main thing is, like, that two-player sort of, like, puzzle campaign. But
yeah, nice. So I have not bought that yet, but we did play the demo together to completion, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And a really good showcase for, I think, what the console can do in that way.
Yeah.
And just, you set it up, you play it, and I think there could be more games like that. I think Mario Kart will work well in that scenario. You know, there's a...
Yeah, I think it's also, like, worth mentioning that Nintendo had that, I hate to say this word, but the Nindies conference or whatever, like, the Nintendo Direct thing where, like, they basically sort of announced that they're partnering with a bunch of different sort of, like, indie developers and, like, some, as a sort of oxymoronic as the term is, independent publishers in, like, the Devolver Digital kind of way, that there are some of those, or, like, Adult Swim Games, or these publishers that sort of grab independent developers and sort of put their games out there, which obviously means that they are not independent games because they are published by a company, but fucking whatever, that word indie means nothing anymore. But yeah, Nintendo did, in what is, I think, actually the strongest look they've had for the Switch outside of just, like, the pitch of it.
I agree.
Since, like, their announcement video, they're like, yes, like, all these games, and then, like, a couple, like, three or four sort of, like, timed exclusives, but then, like, a bunch of old indie games, all these are going to come out on the Switch at some point. It's like, how did you not have that at your announcement thing? Why did you not do that instead of having fucking, like, Suda51 come up and talk about a game that he was kind of thinking he would like to make on the Nintendo Switch someday, and not just have, like, show me Bit Trip Runner 3, like, show me the fucking Rogue Legacy, or, like, show me below, like, whatever the indie games that they were talking about? There's such a perfect platform for indie games that is by far the thing that, like other than Zelda, is the thing that's like, okay, the Switch sounds like maybe a good idea to get in the future, because you can play Zelda and Mario and then all these other indie games that would work best on this platform.
Absolutely. Like, they're going to put Stardew Valley out on this.
Yeah.
I have not bought Stardew Valley again outside of my Mac. I will 100% get that for the Switch. I feel like I have no purpose to play that, like, on the PS4, because I don't know if I'd want to sit down and just have it there.
Yeah.
But for the Switch, if I can go back and forth, that would absolutely be my ideal way to play that game. And, yeah. I mean, that whole Nindies showcase, dumb name, but they had a lot of cool games. Some of them exclusives for the Switch, some of them ports and stuff. But a lot of cool stuff. Like, next week, the March 9th, there's that sequel to an NES game. I forget what it's called. Something Zero.
Blaster Master or Master Blaster Zero. Zero. Yeah.
It looks really neat. Like, yeah. I saw some footage of that. I have not played Blaster Master before, but I know of it, and it looks like a really neat thing that I'm just glad is coming out.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, the Shovel Knight, the new campaign for that, launched exclusively on the Switch for now. It'll come out to other stuff later. But, you know, that's on there, and I know people love that game. I've never played that one personally.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that could be a real haven for that. And everything I've heard from indie developers who talk about the Switch is that it's super easy to develop for.
Yeah.
Because it's using that NVIDIA architecture that they're already familiar with.
Yeah. So, like, as long as Nintendo's able to keep that up, I think that is, like, their best pitch for this console of, like, if they have... Because, obviously, they have, for a long time, they have lost the main big AAA publishers, Ubisoft, EA, like, all those... Activision, like, they are not going to put out games on the Switch, or if they do, they'll be, like, weird, small, like, Grow Home or something like that from Ubisoft. Like, Switch is just never going to get those games, and, like, until or if Nintendo ever decides to make a console that is, like, technologically comparative to the other platforms, like, so what Sony's putting out, those publishers are never going to come to a Nintendo's platform. But if you can fill up the gaps between the, like, two or three big Nintendo games that come out that year with a bunch of small indie titles for a platform that, like, obviously those indie games are going to come out everywhere because that, like, independent developer needs them to come out everywhere. But the Switch is obviously the ideal platform for a game like that because of its portability and its ability to play it on a big TV. Yeah. Like, that is the right strategy, and I just hope that, like, Nintendo will keep that up, and it's not just, like, a first volley. Like, I hope that maintains pace, and I think it probably will.
Yeah, and, you know, they're not going to get, like you said, you know, like, Call of Duty 17 or something, but, you know, Activision and all these big publishers have these growing indie arms and these small, sure, yeah, you know, smaller game arms. And that's going to be a thing that I think is going to come to the Switch. So, you know, like, you know, one of the games I'm most excited for on this thing that's coming out is it's coming out for other consoles, but Sonic Mania.
You're right, yeah.
That's going to be a perfect game for this. And yeah. That's going to be launching.
Well, we'll have to see how that D-pad holds up on a 2D game. That might be, sure, that might be troublesome.
Yeah, we'll see. And you know, yeah, so we'll see with that. But yeah, it's a cool thing that it's going to be there. So, yeah, I mean, I really like this hardware. I'm trying to think of what other things I should talk about. The dock is interesting because it's very small. It's got that, you've probably seen in unboxing videos and stuff, like a little box on the back where you put your cords into, yeah, so you can really easily organize them. Small touch, but nice. I appreciate that. And you put your AC adapter in there, and you put your HDMI cord in there, and you're good to go. That's it. And then you dock it and undock it. Really easy to do. It doesn't feel like it has to click into place, really. You just kind of put it there, and something is connecting with that USB-C port, obviously. Yeah. But you're not, like, feeling it in the way, like, I don't know, you're plugging in, like, a micro USB into your PS4 controller, and you're always thinking, like, I'm going to fucking break this, because micro, right, USB, yeah, is the goddamn worst connection we have ever made as humans.
I feel like we're finally getting to the point where all of our, like, connections going forward are going to be able to be, like, interchangeable front and back.
Yes.
Because how has it taken it this long for the human species to get there? This is the kind of shit that leads to, like, the downfall of civilization and Horizon Zero Dawn having to build it up from the bottom and be like, we're never doing that again. We're never doing non-flippable cables. It's just a nightmare.
It's actually one of the more forward-looking things about the Switch is that it's all USB-C.
Yeah.
Very smart of them to go with that. Because that makes it a lot... It's going to be easier to use in the future. Right now, like, we don't have a lot of USB-C cables, but, you know, soon that is going to be the big thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but anyway, that's neat. So I like the dock. My biggest complaint with, like, what comes in the box is the AC adapter. The cord is not long enough.
Huh.
Like, it's fine if you can have an outlet relatively close, but I try to get all my, like, electronic stuff behind the TV, and it wasn't long enough to do that. I had to kind of use a port on the side, and that was just a little awkward. But, you know, whatever, it's fine. Yeah. I also kind of wish in the box they had given you, like, I don't know, just like an extra USB-C cable or something so that you can plug it into other places. Although I know there's you have to be a little careful because this is not like an iPhone. It cannot be charged by anything. It needs something more powerful in terms of power draw.
Right.
Because it's got a really big battery in it. Like people saying that like the battery life sucks, you got to consider that a little bit. Like,
well, that's like the battery life sucks because our battery technology has not advanced in a significant way in a long time. Like, yes. Our batteries suck.
Yeah, it's not, to me, that's not a Nintendo problem. That no. is, for this thing, that you can play a game like Breath of the Wild for a solid 3 hours on a device like this is kind of miraculous, even if it's not what we would want.
Yeah, I mean, it is obviously still, if like you are wanting a device that you can use on like a long flight or something, that still means that the Switch is maybe not exactly what you're looking for. But it is like, but there is no version of the Switch that has a much longer battery life than that. Like, that's just not possible.
Even the 3DS and Vita don't have much longer battery life. Yeah. The new Vita is actually pretty good. It's got much better life than the original. But that's the best right now, and you know, that's pretty old hardware at this point. So, you know, I'm sure there will be a revision of the Switch down the line with a better battery and stuff, but there are things that Nintendo is limited by, like physics, you know. But it's got a pretty good battery in it. It's optimized well, too, that it charges kind of slowly when games are playing, and that also helps it from not having too much heat draw or something like that. So it all works pretty seamlessly and smoothly. Into some of the problems people have had, I know the left Joy-Con sync issue is a thing. And I'm in that annoying position where I have not had a single problem with it, so I can't comment on that. And I hate to be in that situation because I'm not trying to say it doesn't exist. Obviously it does, and it's widespread enough to be troubling. I have, you know, a living room, and but it's pretty open, like the line of sight, so I've been fine. I use it in a lot of different situations or, you know, positions, just like my arm down here or my arm up here, and I haven't noticed any, you know, maybe it's going out of sync on the loading screens and I just don't notice it, but so far in a couple days and, you know, maybe 20 hours of play, I have not had a single problem with it. It's too bad that is an issue, obviously, for people.
I just want to read, because I brought up this earlier today, because I just think, you know, obviously, it's something that any launch hardware has some of these issues, and it seems like the left Joy-Con thing is like, there are definitely people that are affected by the issue, and like some of them are affected by it very severely by what I've read online, but it is not like an insane, like it's not like every single unit is failing. But I did think that when Nintendo had an official statement a couple of days on their website about the Joy-Con thing, which is the first time they've really like said anything specific about it, and I just found the thing they put out is really funny, just like it, how specific it is. So I just kind of want to read this. So, what to do? Try these steps. 1, ensure your console has the latest system update. 2, ensure that Joy-Con controllers are charged, with a link to how to do that. 3, try to decrease the distance between the Joy-Con and the Nintendo Switch console. 4, ensure that the Nintendo Switch console is placed to minimize interference with the Joy-Con. It is best if the Nintendo Switch console is placed out in the open and that it is not behind a TV, near an aquarium, placed in or under a metal object, pressed against a large amount of wires and cords, within 3 to 4 feet of another wireless device such as a wireless speaker or wireless access point. 5, check for possible sources of interference and turn them off. Interference can be caused by devices such as laptops, tablets, etc., wireless headsets, wireless printers, microwaves, wireless speakers, cordless phones, USB 3.0 compatible devices such as hard drives, thumb drives, LAN adapters, etc. In most cases, it will be enough to move these devices 3 to 4 feet away from the Nintendo Switch console and or Joy-Con controllers. However, if you continue to experience this issue, please power these devices off while using the Nintendo Switch console. That's like such an insane list of like things that every single person has in their living room where they put their console, of like cords. I mean, not aquariums. I don't know if, you know, I have my secret underground like bunker aquarium, but hopefully that won't quite interfere with the Nintendo Switch.
It is a weird scenario where, you know, I will just say right now, if you want to know my setup, it is under my PS4, above my Xbox One, next to my Wii U. The router is probably 10 feet away.
Yeah.
It's below also an AV receiver and speakers, though those speakers are not wireless, but there are cords everywhere, and it's been totally fine for me, probably a pitch of 6 to 7 feet. So, like, clearly I think two people could have a Switch in similar circumstances and it could work differently.
Yeah, and obviously, like, it might be... Because Nintendo has frustratingly, like, not said anything specific about the issue other than that, like, QA thing on their site. Which is, like, part of the reason why that is just so funny is, like, it has to be written that way, but at the same time, them saying, if you're experiencing these issues, please turn all these devices off while you play your Nintendo Switch console. It's like, fuck you, I'm not going to turn off my cordless phone, as I've got my cordless phone in 2017, and I'm very proud of my cordless phone. Thank you very much. Yes. But it is... So obviously they just have to write it that way, even if it's really funny. But it is something where I can see if you are having issues with that, it is where, like, that... Putting that statement out from Nintendo, like, that is the most least helpful fucking thing on the planet. Because unless you have a huge fucking aquarium between you and where your Nintendo Switch is, it seems like you're going to have no idea probably what's causing the interference. Because like you said, like, if I had it where my TV is, like, next to my PS4 and my fucking sound system and shit, there's so many random cables and, like, modems and fucking, like, wireless speakers and all this shit. I would have no idea what could possibly be causing that kind of interference. Like, we just live in a world where we are, like, bathed in fucking radio signals constantly from every single angle, and most devices that put out, like, Bluetooth don't really have these kinds of issues, and the fact that the left Joy-Con in particular, a lot of them are having certain degrees of, like, either... Like, only a little bit, and I have seen some of, like, people saying that, like, basically if it is not directly attached to the Switch, it's not connecting to it almost at all. And it's like, that is sort of, like, a weird, frustrating thing, obviously, for the people who have it, that we don't, of normal, average Bluetooth devices don't have that kind of problem anymore. At least in my experience.
Yeah. So it's weird. I do think it's maybe been blown a little out of proportion in some circles, where I think if you were on the outside, you might think every system is affected.
Yeah.
And it's not, maybe... But maybe not. Like, it's really hard to know.
It is something where it is just widespread enough that if I was someone looking to get a Switch, like, unless you just, like, needed to play the Zelda so bad you just couldn't even stand it, I would wait for the first sort of, like, revision. Not like the Switch Slim, but, like, the first thing where they, like, kind of tinker with the insides a little bit of all the stuff to, like, make it
work. Or they issue a clear update or some kind of...
Yeah, when they say, like, come out and say, like, this is what the problem was and we have fixed it, either, like, with the new version of the Switch or with a firmware update that has very clearly fixed it, like, I personally would, like, wait for that, because the idea of that problem affecting me would be annoying enough, and it does seem... Not like it's not like 50% of consoles or something that have it, but like it is just enough that of people reporting it that's like, it's a bit cagey to me.
It's not the Red Ring of Death.
No.
But it could be annoying.
Yeah, I mean, also, if it was the Red Ring of Death, we wouldn't know until a couple of months, because those Xbox 360s didn't die immediately.
No. So yeah, I mean, I think like your setup here, you'd probably be fine. My brother has said he has a little tiny bit here and there, so I don't know what that is. He's actually in a smaller space than I am, but overall not a problem.
Yeah.
I think the biggest warning is if you're someone who has like a giant home theater and like you have a much longer pitch and like a lot more equipment, then maybe think about it. But I'm not in that situation really. Yeah. But I've got a lot of, you know, so it's fine.
I mean, you're just going to be so bummed when you like bring your TV to the local aquarium and you're like, I'm going to play some fucking Zelda surrounded by nature and fish and water, yeah, and it's going to be so beautiful and serene. And then you're like, this doesn't fucking work because I'm in an aquarium. What the fuck, Nintendo? And then you mail the Switch back to them.
That would probably be fine because you'd have the Joy-Cons attached to the system. And...
No, I said you brought your TV because you don't want to play it on their like fucking 720p screen. You want to play it on like the best screen you have.
So I do want
to... Your 4K curved TV that you bring to the local aquarium, which is something that we all do all the time.
The last thing I did want to talk about was the screen on the handheld unit itself. It's really gorgeous. It is 720p, but don't let that scare you. That's handheld screens right now, and I mean like iPhones, all this stuff, have way too high a resolution anyway. Like, you don't need iPhones are fine, they're 1080p, but like my brother has like a Samsung that's an OLED 4K. It's like, it's so stupid. You don't need that for a phone. So anyway, like, it's perfectly fine. It's really clear, really bright, beautiful IPS display. I would say if you've ever owned like a PlayStation Vita, very similar to that, although not, you know, higher resolution and looks a little nicer. And in your hands, the screen feels huge because it's like a 6.2-inch screen, which is much bigger than most handheld devices you'd use, but not to the point where it feels like you can't use it as a portable. It's a little bigger and heavier than most portables. You wouldn't use it in the same way you would a Game Boy Advance SP or something.
I mean, it's the kind of thing where you have your carrying case over there, and it's like, it seems like a device where you need a carrying case, and like, if you're taking it with you somewhere, you're going to throw that carrying case in your backpack, you know? Yeah. You're not going to like stuff it in like your jacket pocket, which is something I've done with my Vita a couple of times, you know?
Sure, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, that's... Frankly, that's where a lot of these things are evolving to. Like, I think the era of handheld consoles that you just stick in your pocket and fold down is dying, and that's been dying for a while.
Yeah.
So it's fine, and again, those trade-offs I think are worth it, if that you can do both, you know, the handheld and the docked and all that stuff. But beautiful screen. I have played, you know, a decent amount, maybe an hour or two of Zelda that way, and I've brought it around, and it is just, it's really cool. And, you know, like, it's not the best way to play Zelda, because Zelda is this big, expansive, open-world game, but it's amazing just how well it holds up there. And even just little things like, sometimes I just want to go to a different room and play. And you don't realize how much of a nice little luxury that is with this thing. It's just really convenient and nice to do that. And so I like that about it. Beautiful screen. There is the interesting thing where Zelda has some frame rate dips when you're playing it docked.
Because it bumps it up to 900p, but it seems like the way it is overclocking the processor does not, like, make up for the increase in resolution.
Yeah, it's, and, you know, to me, mostly it hasn't bothered me because, one, it's the kind of frame rate dips you get on 99% of open world games like this. That's not, to me, like, for unless the game is raining and it's windy and there's a bunch of characters on screen, to me the frame rate does not get all that distracting. And there was one area where I was doing some stuff with the Zoras. Hopefully that's not a spoiler that the Zoras are in this game.
Zoras are in this Legend of Zelda game, Jonathan. You have destroyed my curiosity for this game. I don't even care anymore.
And it was really rainy and windy and all this stuff, and the frame rate got a little too distracting. And so I just pulled it out and played it on docked, and that was nice. Like, obviously not ideal that it has those performance
that's
issues.
That's kind of a weird thing to say. It's like, I was having all these frame rate issues on the TV version, so I just yanked it out of the TV and played the 720p version. It's kind of a weird thing to say.
But I don't know. It's kind of cool that there's that option. I think what they should maybe do is, if this is at all possible, to have an option like in the menu where when you're playing it docked, play at 900p, but know you might have these issues, or just run it the same way it does on the handheld.
Do the thing that Neo does and call it, like, it's action mode and cinematic mode.
Yeah. It's but you know, to me it's fine. Like, I do think, I mean, the increase in resolution, and there are also just other effects that happen, is noticeable, and it looks really beautiful on the TV, and yes, you do have some frame rate drops. Like I said, most of the time, if I even notice them, it doesn't bother me at all, in part because this is just not a game that is dependent on frame rate most of the time to have the best experience.
Sure.
And, you know, it's the first game on new hardware. That it's running that well undocked, like the 720p mode, just on the unit, and has almost no frame rate dips, is pretty cool, because, like, one downside is that if you get, like, the Wii U version, it's running 720p and has those frame rate dips, and there's no other method to play it.
Yeah.
So there's no real recourse for that. So if that really bothers you, the Switch version, you know, you do at least have the undocked version that runs a little better in those ways with that little visual trade-off. But it's amazing how well it, you know, it holds up on that screen. I think looks really nice and gorgeous. So overall, very happy with the Nintendo Switch. I'm excited to see where this thing goes. There are, again, it's pretty bare bones right now in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because it, like, doesn't have any sort of downloadable app at all on the eStore, right? Like, you can't.
There's just games.
Yeah, there's just games.
Yeah, the only thing you can do on this thing right now is play games. It is a little weird it didn't launch with Netflix or YouTube, but I'm sure they'll be there eventually. Hope the virtual console will be good. The point is, I think it's a really solid foundation. I think that UI is great and can be built up on, but it's a really good foundation. I think, you know, the console itself seems like it's a really good balance of all these things, even if it's not perfect in certain areas. I think it's got a lot of promise if they can support it with things like virtual console, and they can keep rolling out games like, you know, Breath of the Wild and Super Mario Odyssey that look like really, really compelling experiences, and if they can have those indies come at a constant flow, and if they can, you know, frankly, this sounds stupid, but it is important in this day and age, have the ports of things like Mario Kart 8 and Splatoon and those things that people might have missed on the Wii U, and they can get those over here now and build up that base of games. I think this could be really compelling. Is it something you need to rush out and buy right now? Not necessarily, although, if you don't own a Wii U, and you don't own a Nintendo Switch, and you want to play Breath of the Wild, which you should because holy fucking shit, it's pretty goddamn compelling. And that's the last, I need to get into Breath of the Wild now because it is really impossible, and I've heard a lot of journalists say this, to separate your thoughts on the Switch from your thoughts on Breath of the Wild, and frankly, that's what good launch software should do.
Sure.
You know, good launch software is something like Mario 64, where you say, the Nintendo 64 launched with pretty much just this one game, but look at that one game. That's a compelling reason to get this thing. And I think Breath of the Wild is that fucking game. Again, it's a little bit of a different scenario because it is technically cross-platform. But yeah, the last time a system, like a home console, launched with a game this significant was probably Halo 1 for the Xbox. It's been a while.
And I don't know, Condemned Criminal Origins was pretty good on the 360. Nobody, when that console launched, nobody was looking at that and saying, that's going to be the best game that launches with this console that makes that you're going to want to play, and, but it sure fucking was.
And look, Knack is getting a sequel.
Yeah, exactly.
Multimedia franchise extraordinaire Knack launch game. Fuck Zelda, you got Knack.
Knack 2.
Knack 2.
Yes. I mean, I think it's technically supposed to be pronounced Knack 2, but I don't know.
Is it? I thought it was just Knack.
No, it's definitely, it's Knack.
Okay.
I mean, that's not a silent K at the beginning. It's not a silent K at the end. It's a fucking K sandwich with Knack in the middle, motherfucker.
All right, well, let's move on and talk a little bit about Breath of the Wild. And I could just go on for this game, about this game for hours, because holy fucking shit. But I will try to keep it at least semi-directed.
Okay. I have first question. Are the robot dinosaurs in it?
No.
Okay.
All right, so there are so many angles I could tackle this from. But the thing I want to start with, and the thing that has wowed me the most, and is the hardest to explain if you haven't played it, is that Breath of the Wild manages something that I have never seen a game do or even really attempt, which is that this is a game with a story, and right. There's a lot of, you know, the story stuff in this is amazing, and I'll talk a little bit about it without getting too in-depth about that, but Breath of the Wild is as non-linear as a game could possibly be while still having a story that has a beginning and an end. The middle is whatever the hell you want it to be.
Sure.
But it does have to start somewhere and it does have to end somewhere, but within that chunk, the everything else, which is the bulk of the game, is as non-linear as a game could possibly be. And it's hard to explain because I don't think any other game has gone for something quite like this. The closest comparison I can think of with open world games is a Skyrim.
Yeah.
But even in a Skyrim, let's say you want to follow the main quest.
Okay.
Or any other quest line. A quest line. That is still sequential. That is still, sure. You go here and you have to do that. And then you go here and you have to do that. And it is sequential. And within the overall like soup that is Skyrim of all the different quests and all the things you can do, it is whatever you make of it. But there is still some semblance of linearity to those things. Breath of the Wild, and I'm exaggerating a little bit here, but I did feel this at different points, makes Skyrim feel positively on rails in how much... Like, here's how Breath of the Wild works. Is you start, you wake up as Link, you've been asleep for 100 years, you're like, what the fuck is going on? You meet this old man who helps you go to these four shrines, and you get the basic tools you need to play the game. And that's all on the Great Plateau. And you play that and you think, the Great Plateau is really big. Like, how much bigger is this world? Because this is, there's an ice area over there that took me 2 hours to figure out, and there's just all this, and there's this, you know, desert area just within this little Great Plateau. It's really crazy. And then finally, you get your abilities, and you go to this tower, and I'm doing this a little out of order, but you get go to this tower, and you get to the top of the tower, and that's where you get your first piece of the map filled in on your Sheikah slate. And you look at that map, and you're like, okay, this is the Great Plateau, pretty cool, and then you're like, oh, I'm zoomed in right now. And you zoom out, and you zoom out, and your jaw fucking drops because you are looking at a tiny sliver of this map that I have played like 20 hours of this game, and I have seen relatively little of it. It is enormous. Absolutely enormous. And once you get off the Great Plateau, which is absolutely not like... It is functionally tutorial-esque in that it gives you everything you need, but it is not at all tutorial-esque in the sense of there's an owl or an old dude or something like that who is going to show you how to swing a stick for 2 hours.
And then is going to ask you if you want to hear everything they said again, only in a very confusing, phrased way that you don't know whether you want to say yes or no to it.
Yeah. No, even the Great Plateau makes it feel open. But once you get off the Great Plateau, you get your first entry in the main quest. And you think this is going to be like Skyrim-esque where there's a main quest line. No.
There's one quest in this game, motherfucker.
There is one... Overall, like, the quest you get, and it is defeat Ganon.
That is such a great fucking idea for a game, that just you, because I've seen that part in a video where you leave, and you just get this big text on screen that's like, motherfucker, just beat Ganon. It's like, okay, I'll go beat Ganon, I guess.
They set up the story, they give you what you need, and then they say, you see Hyrule Castle over there with all that scary shit? All right, Ganon's there, Zelda's there, you gotta save them. Save Zelda, save Hyrule, Ganon's there, defeat Ganon, and then from there it's... Do whatever the hell you fucking want, because there's a lot of things you I would maybe not need to, because there's already been someone who's speedrun this game.
Yeah.
But you probably need to, unless you're a crazy person, to actually get there and do this. But whatever order you want to do those things in, you can do it however the hell you want. If you want to start by going to the furthest edge of the map, and I haven't actually gone here yet, but going to whatever this game's equivalent of Gerudo Valley is, and meeting them and doing all of that, and kind of ignoring a lot of other stuff.
And learning how to play their dope theme song and acoustic guitar.
Yeah, you could do that. If you want to just, you've seen Death Mountain because your fucking wallpaper has Death Mountain on the back of it that you've had on your laptop for a year now, and you really want to go there because this is a game where if you see it, you can go there and you can interact with it, you could start there. Like, it's kind of amazing the openness of this game. And within that, there is also this sense that I have never felt this strongly with an open world game, at least, and maybe a game, period, where every single gameplay mechanic and gameplay system in this game has purpose and is linked to every other single gameplay mechanic and gameplay system. It is one of the most unified gameplay experiences I have ever seen. There is no way to, like, waste your time in this game because everything you do will have purpose. If you're just wandering around out in the fields and you kill some goblins. They're called macoblins. What are they?
Macoblins.
Macoblins, yeah. You kill some macoblins, and you get some of their weapons, and that'll be useful later because you cycle through weapons really fast in this game. And then you go, and with one of those weapons, you chop down a tree, and you get some bundles of wood, and you get some apples. And then later, you might have a hard enemy, so you're going to need to cook with those apples and make a meal for yourself that you can use to restore hearts. And, you know, all of that is linked. And then you can go defeat that enemy, and that enemy might give you something, and then that might lead you to a shrine. And there's 120 shrines in this game, and you got to get those, and those will get you the heart containers or the stamina vessels, which will allow you to do more in the game. I'm just describing, like, this little sliver of it, but it really is. It takes that core thing I love about, like, A Link to the Past or Ocarina of Time, where there's no junk in those games.
Right,
there's no fat on the bones of those games, even though, especially for the time, big, expansive adventures, but there's nothing in there that's just junk, you know? Like you get in a lot of modern open world games.
Yeah, there's not 500 feathers scattered around the map to go pick up so your mom knits you a fucking cape with it.
Right, no, what you're doing is that, what game? Is that a real
game? Assassin's Creed 2. Okay, that is Assassin's Creed 2. The collectibles in that game are a bunch of feathers. And if you collect all the feathers, your mom, who hasn't, like, said anything for, like, the whole game since your family was murdered, knits, like, a fucking cape for you or something that has the Auditori crest on it.
Of course, it's fucking Assassin's Creed. I thought you were making up something ludicrous.
No, that is, like, I was talking to someone about this just the other day about that I did all of that, and then, like, that was the moment where I was like, I'm never doing this in another fucking video game again because this was the stupidest shit. It was the worst possible reward you could have possibly given me, and I was very bad about it.
But, you know, Zelda has always, I think, had this ethos, kind of like Metroid does too, where anything you get directly helps you. So, you know, in Legend of Zelda, you're often, you know, one of the things you'll find on the map are the heart pieces. And you get enough heart pieces and you get a heart container. And that is absolutely worth the effort because that extra heart is totally going to come in handy at some point, right?
Yeah.
And Breath of the Wild is that same way, where one of the strokes of genius in this game, among many, is the shrine system. There are dungeons in this game, and I don't know how much I'm going to go into that, but there are semi-traditional Legend of Zelda dungeons, sort of, and we'll explain that in a little bit. But the main kind of dungeon-esque experience you're going to get out of this is Hyrule is littered with over 100, I'm not sure of the exact number, something like 120,
yeah,
shrines. And those shrines do a couple of things for you. When you get to one of them and you activate it, it's a quick travel point. And that's actually the main... The towers are quick travel points. There's 12 of those. But then the shrines are the main quick travel points. So sometimes they're very strategically placed. Like, you can't fast travel into Kakariko Village, but there's a shrine near it. And that also means it's cool that you always, when you travel somewhere, you get an awesome vista shot and you get to kind of approach the town. You don't just wind up in it. You're always encouraged to kind of appreciate nature and the settings and all that stuff. But anyway, so you get the shrine travel point, but you go into the shrine and it's like one or two or three rooms with some kind of puzzle going on. It actually, you know, this game, we're going to talk about the different influences in a little bit, very much feels like Portal or Portal 2.
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of places. I've seen, like, some footage of someone completing one of the shrines, and it definitely has that, like, very kind of stark, you're in this puzzle room, and you have your access to, like, your five or six different, like, sort of mechanics that you can play with, like, freezing water and that kind of shit. And it's just like, solve this, like, puzzle, and then it kind of iterates it once or twice, and then you get your thing.
Yes, exactly. And not in a sense where it, like, feels like you're playing Portal. I just mean it's kind of structurally like that. It feels like Zelda.
Yeah, and it's like the kind of puzzle mechanics of that. It is like you have this sort of ability or small set of abilities that exists within your sort of like larger ability just to kind of move around this room and interact with things. And it builds puzzles with that as opposed to other puzzle games of like something like The Witness, you know, that's like,
right.
That it's like, you know, it's a literal puzzle on like a piece of paper, basically. It is more of like this active sort of like physics engagement with your environment. And that's what the puzzle is actually built out of.
And it's something I'm going to talk a lot about with this game, but that everything that this game does that feels new, like the shrines, to me is really a way of recapturing something that has always been great about Zelda and putting it in a sense that really puts that front and center. And some of that is just that the Zelda people clearly have always been good at designing those dungeons. And those dungeons can be really fun. But there is something great about them just getting to do like 100 of these and just maybe this idea can't support a full dungeon, but it can support a 5 to 10 minute little puzzle room.
Yeah.
And that's great. And that experience is wonderful. And it even, you know, improves upon that pace where if you're someone like Sean, you talked about with our Zelda retrospective, that you don't always love kind of the length of some of the dungeons and the pace gets a little...
Yeah, that they get tedious to me at some point.
It's hard to feel that with the shrines because go in, spend 5 to 10 minutes in there, go out and do 100 other different things, and then you can go back to another shrine. So it really allows you to play at whatever pace you want to do with that. So, but anyway, you complete a shrine, you get an orb. Complete 4 shrines, get 4 orbs, then you can trade those in for either a heart container or a stamina container. So you can up your hearts and your stamina. So over time, the more shrines you do, the stronger you'll get, the more stamina you'll have, the more of the world you can easily access. You can technically access everything right off the bat, but if you only have 3 hearts and base stamina, it's going to be really hard to get to Ganon.
Right.
Someone will do it because this game is like daring people to speedrun it.
Right.
More than like any game I've ever seen. Because if you want to speedrun Ocarina of Time, what you're doing is finding glitches. If you want to speedrun Breath of the Wild, what you're doing is figuring out how can I cheese the game with only 3 hearts.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I'm excited to see the speedrun.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of like Dark Souls speedruns of like where people just like, you never level up because like leveling up takes time. So it's like, I'm just running past shit and like finding some weird way to kill this boss with like my bare hands. And you look at that, you're like, how the fuck did this person do that with like, if you got hit by that thing, you would just die immediately. I have no idea how you could possibly play that game that way.
Yeah, but the shrines are a wonderful example of how everything in the game feels so interconnected. Because maybe you're exploring Hyrule, you see off in the distance there's one of those towers. If you go light that tower, you'll get the topography of the map. And from that tower is a really high point. And high points in this game are great because from those high points, the draw distance is incredible and you can see everything. And you can figure out where you want to go. And you can even pull out, the Sheikah Slate has this feature where you push it on the right stick. And it's like a little telescope. And from that, you can say, put a pin there.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key things they've done with this game is that when you climb up your tower and do your thing, you synchronize or whatever for Assassin's Creed, it is not like, you know, putting every single thing that is in that area on your map is like, this is where you do the hunting thing, blah, 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 blah. It will reveal the sort of topography of the map, but all the things that are there, you have to look through your binocular and then like press a button that will then put a like pin basically in your map that says, there's something interesting here, there's something interesting here. But it's up to you to sort of survey the environment and decide what looks interesting that you want to like mark to go to later.
The game wants you to go on an adventure.
Yeah.
And it only wants to provide you with sort of the bare minimum that you'll need to go on that adventure, but never to hold your hand. And I've never seen a game kind of try to strike that exact balance, even a Zelda game. And it's really fascinating in that way. But yeah, you know, from that tower, you find some shrines. You go to those shrines, you're able to get more powerful, and you can go to other places. It's just this wonderful gameplay loop, and that's just a tiny little sliver of it. Because in that sense of, like, it is all open to you wherever you want to go, however what you want to do it, one of the sort of main things in the overall quest to defeat Ganon is sort of the way the story is set up is... in sort of the four corners of Hyrule, they, long ago, 10,000 years ago, part of the lore is there were these 4 divine beasts that would help to defeat Ganon. And since then, as part of the calamity that kind of put Hyrule into the ruin that it is now, those divine beasts were taken over by Ganon. So one of the things you're supposed to do, like one of the main objectives, is free all of the 4 divine beasts. And that leads to basically the way that the dungeons work in this. But you can tackle those in any order you want.
Choose not to tackle them, I guess, if you want to just say, yeah, fuck it, I'm just going to kill Ganon. Fuck these divine beasts, I don't need that shit. Yeah. I'm Link. I've done this a couple of times, I think I can kill Ganon.
Yeah, and it might be really hard if you don't do those things, but you can kind of go in whatever order. The game is not blocking you off literally at any point, like where you need, I need the hook shot to get across this. There's never anything like that. There are some scenarios where you might be like, right, I'm really not ready with three hearts or anything. But here's the thing, that can also lead to some of the most fun experiences, because it's really easy to go off the beaten path in this game and get to an area where you're like, oh, that's a giant Mokoblin. I cannot fight that. That thing will kill me. Like, even if I have seven hearts, it will take all of them away in one hit. There are definitely enemies like that, and you can get real fucked up. But then sometimes you'll get there and you'll get real fucked up, and then you'll be like, you know what? I'm going to figure this out. I am going to kill this encampment of enemies that I am in no way prepared to fight for. I don't have the gear, I don't have the hearts, I don't have the stamina, but I'm going to figure it out, and that has led to some of the most satisfying combat encounters I have ever had in a game. So the combat in this game is essentially like a really great modernized version of Ocarina of Time, where you lock on, you can strafe, you can jump, all of those things, but you feel a lot more mobile because this isn't like a first 3D game from 1996. Right. Or 1998, so it doesn't feel, you know, as stiff in some of those ways. It actually is, I think, very deep and strategic, and I'm only now kind of getting into the deeper complexities of this system because it's really smart. But so you have that battle, you know, you can do all that. You can cook meals and, like, get your different ingredients and put those together, and maybe you make a meal that gives you an attack boost or gives you extra hearts or will give you a heightened defense or heightened speed, or you can use some stealth. Like, it'll increase your stealth, so when you walk, you're a little quieter. So everything you need is out there in the world to do whatever you want to do. It's just up to you to figure out how to find it. And that's one of those things where when I say it, I sound like I'm maybe a developer bullshitting at E3, because you hear that kind of thing a lot. But they've really pulled that off in this game, and I'm saying that from experience, not from, like, marketing speak, you know? So, like, I had this scenario where I had to go down, like, I got a little side quest from this kid in Hateno Village, which is a really cool little village in the mountains, and said, hey, these dicks down at the beach are stealing my sheep. I was like, can you go down to the beach and fuck those people up?
Can you instead go down to the beach and fucking steal his sheep for yourself and become a shepherd with stolen sheep?
I don't think you can.
Damn it.
Yeah. Maybe in the next game.
Yeah.
Breath of the Wild 2, you can do that.
Put the morality system in it and you just fucking slaughter the sheep.
Yes. Like,
fuck you, I'm Dark Link.
Weirdly, Link basically is a witcher in this game because people are asking him to go kill a lot of evil creatures from Ganon. So anyway, but no, I went down to the beach. I kind of sailed. It was a long journey to get there, and it was a lot of fun because there's nothing more entertaining. It's the thing like in a Bethesda game where the best thing to do is just pick a direction and go and see what you find. But I went down to the beach, and I kind of snuck up on these guys, and I was like, what quite am I going to do here? And I made a mistake, and one of them came over and killed me in one hit. And I was like, fuck, what do I do? And so you have to kind of come up with a plan. I started using, like, bombs, because I noticed they had one, like, bomb barrel. So I was able to take out a couple of them with a big explosion. And then I had a couple more to take care of. And, you know, I wound up using a selection of, like, different arrows and different abilities and just sort of trying to cheese my way through the fight using some abilities I'd gotten from, like, the cooking and things like that. And it's in moments like that where you realize how absolutely unified everything you're doing in this game is, because all the stuff you collect, that then you cook and you use those cooking materials to be able to survive tough fights and do things like that. And I had gotten this side quest from journeying to this village, and I traveled down here, and there was a shrine off in the distance that I was absolutely going to go figure out my way to once I'd killed these fucking Mokoblins and gotten the sheep back and things like this. So, you know, it's a great adventure because everything you do leads to something else. Every action you take in the game helps you in the long run in some way, shape, or form. And whatever story you kind of want to craft with the game on your way to defeating Ganon, which is, you just know that's the ending. The game will end when I go to defeat Ganon. But along the way, do what you want, and there will be some amazing crafted story materials for you along the way, but it's completely nonlinear in how you want to experience those things. And I don't even know if I'm explaining this well, but it is such a unique rush to have a game like this. And Zelda has flirted with it before. Clearly A Link Between Worlds, the 3DS game, was a dry run for this.
Yeah.
In that game, once it opens up, you can do the seven dungeons in any order. But even that feels on rails in comparison, because that still has, at set points, there are set story things that need to happen before the world can open up again. And then the bulk of the game is you have those seven dungeons you need to hit, and different stories are told along the way. But it also means kind of the main crux of the story has to happen in certain places along the road. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In Breath of the Wild, that's not the case, because they've even found ways to tell what is a pretty beautiful and in-depth story in a completely nonlinear fashion, to a degree where I cannot wait to see the shockwaves this game sends out into not just this industry, but I think it has lessons to teach, like, TV and stuff. I cannot wait for the day someone makes, like, a TV show that you could watch out of order because it's on a streaming service and you could have the episodes watched in any order or something like that. Like, maybe in an anthology format, but you could do something like that. And I think there are things that Breath of the Wild does in opening it up to this linear fashion that are just fascinating to me. So, you know, once you go to, like, the one divine beast I've gone to is the stuff with the Zoras. Okay. I'm not going to spoil anything big, but the whole sort of Zora story that I got into was, you know, I figured, okay, I'm going to... I got into these wetlands completely on accident because I was looking for something else, and then my horse and I got to the edge of a cliff, and I'm like, sorry, horse, you have to stay here because you can't get down this thing. And so I sailed off, and then I'm in these wetlands, and I find this shrine. And then next to a shrine is a Zora swimming in a pool, and the Zora's like, hey, our prince is looking for a Hylian. Can you come help us? And anyway, in the long run, this leads to doing one of the big main, you know, four big corner things in the game. But that whole story that was told with the Zoras and the characters that are introduced and what Link learns about what happened 100 years ago, absolutely beautiful. So full of character. Some of the cutscenes in that succession of story were among the best I've ever seen in a game. This game has such a unique sense of cutscenes. One of the things, the voice... There's not a lot of voice acting in this game, actually. I think people from trailers might be surprised. It is still primarily text, is what you interface with. But when they need to do something sort of cinematic or emotional, they'll break out the voice acting.
Okay.
And the voice acting is really good, but what it allows them to do is have these cinematic moments that Zelda, I think, since Ocarina of Time has strived for, like, you know, the scenes we've talked about, like with Saria in the forest, or meeting Zelda for the first time, or things like that, where they have these kind of fun, unique camera angles, and they let the moments linger, and that extra level of, the player doesn't have to do anything, it's just voice acting, and they can completely control the atmosphere in those moments. It really allows them to up their game in those scenes, and it's some really beautiful stuff with some spectacle, because, again, not going to get into exactly how they do dungeons in this, but holy fucking shit, what I did this morning involving the Zora thing. If you've played it, you know what I'm talking about. I texted my brother about it completely by coincidence. He was doing it like an hour or two behind me.
Huh.
And then when he was done with it, I just texted him, holy fucking shit, I won't spoil it for you. And then he finished it, and he was like, that's the coolest thing Nintendo's ever done. And I can totally see how you would think that. It's such a fucking rush. And just the way that whole story wraps up. And you realize, like, in my experience through this game, that's the first of these big four things I did. It could be someone's last. It could be in the middle. It is telling this story that is highly emotional, but again, it is driven by where you want to go with the game. And that's it's so amazing and interesting to me that they've managed to pull that off and make this game that is truly open world. The world is there for you. After an hour on that great plateau, you are ready to tackle it. It's just up to how you are going to adventure with it. And I think that this is potentially a sea change for how these games are made. It feels like Zelda going from feeling, you know, stale in its 3D iterations for maybe the last decade, and then Nintendo surveying the game landscape, realizing kind of where games have gone. All these games that are clearly inspired by Zelda, you know, there would be no Elder Scrolls if there weren't a Legend of Zelda at one point to kind of create this opening for fantasy gaming in the mainstream and things like that. You know, it's a basis for puzzle games like a Portal or something. And Nintendo looking at all these things and taking what they need to and realizing where games have gone and then going further and innovating in the way Nintendo at their best innovate. And it is so beautiful to see them doing this again. This is the best and most innovative and most brilliant game they've made since the Mario Galaxy titles. And that means it's the best thing they've done this decade. So it is just utterly stunning. I love this game to death. There are so many other things I could talk about with the story. The specific way they dole out the relationship between you and Princess Zelda. I don't think I want to spoil. But
Okay. Once
you get into it and you engage with... It's a gameplay system. It's a really cool gameplay system that leads to these cutscenes. And they're beautiful. Zelda has never been more interesting than she is in this game because she is almost like this mentor figure to Link, not just this person he needs to save. And I cannot wait to see kind of the more I play what kind of happens with that. But, you know, that you can have it both ways where you can have this completely open world that is totally at the behest of the player to orient the way they want and go where they want and all this, but still tell a story that feels impactful and has these beautiful aesthetic moments and all this stuff. It's Nintendo doing what they did with A Link to the Past or Ocarina of Time or something and just kicking the ball 100 yards down the field and chasing it. It's amazing. So
does the game partially feel to you inspired, like, not just by like a Skyrim sort of thing, but also like a Minecraft sort of thing? Not necessarily in the crafting and like building, but in the way that the world is sort of like the exploration and adventure aspect of the world is. Does it feel that way to you? Because when I was watching some videos of it, it kind of felt to me like they were combining a lot of the adventure stuff of Skyrim and the adventure stuff of not just Minecraft, but the whole sort of genre of survival PC games that have followed in the wake of Minecraft. Like, it sort of seemed like they took a lot of the systems and ideas from both of those sorts of games and put them together. Did you get that sense? Like, obviously with, like, the story stuff on top of it.
I hadn't thought of Minecraft, but I do think it's a good comparison. I mean, I think you could list an awful lot of games that were influences for Breath of the Wild. You know, I think you can go from Skyrim and other open-world games to things like Minecraft and that survival genre to things like Dark Souls, frankly, people have brought up with just the sheer level of difficulty in parts. Portal, there's a wide range of things going on here. Other Mario games also. Like, there's a clear sense like that I think things like Mario Galaxy and Mario 3D Land helped them on this. But I think Minecraft is an interesting comparison in that one of the beautiful things about Minecraft is you're dropped in the world and it's go make what you want of it. And obviously Breath of the Wild literally is not that same thing because you're dropped in the same place every time and the world does have boundaries and is the world. But that sense of go where you will, make what you will of this.
And everything you find you can use and will be to your advantage in some way.
Yes, absolutely. I think Minecraft and the larger survival genre it is part of and helped proliferate is definitely a good comparison.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you do, at the first, you don't quite realize how much you're going to use everything you get. Like, even the one area of things that I have not used as much of yet, which are like gears and ancient screws that you get from the Guardians and some of the ancient technology, I haven't used them a lot yet, but I know what they're used for. Like, basically, they're used to upgrade some of your runes, which are the stuff in your Sheikah Slate, like your magnetism and your ice and all that stuff. So I just need to get enough of them and kind of invest in that. But I know what I use it for. But everything else, yeah. Like, and you're constantly finding new things. Like, I had this great adventure where I was heading to try to find this one, something related to the Princess Zelda stuff. And I wound up at this stable off in the outskirts, kind of off the Great Plateau and off kind of towards the western edge of the map. And I ended up at this stable and I was like, oh, cool, I haven't had my horse in a while. I can get my horse out of the stable. And at the stable, I got a couple of side quests. And so one of them was this jackass wanted some gourmet meat from this mountain and he wanted me to go hunt it for him. So I thought, well, I haven't been to that mountain. That could be cool. So I headed off to that mountain and I get to the top or to one point on this mountain and then my shrine indicator goes off. So I go and find this shrine. And then after I go and find that shrine, then I'm looking for animals, but I'm not finding a lot of animals, but I do wind up finding these Endura carrots, which are something that I can use to have extra stamina. And then I'm like, oh, there's this thing I needed to do with trying to catch this wild horse. I need this to use that. I can cook that into something, and that will help me up my stamina so I can do that. And so it's just like you get off on these tangents and these adventures, but it doesn't feel sort of aimless and wandering in the way certain open world games, even the best of them, can if you get too far off the beaten track. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because whatever you do, it's like this will help me or this will open something up for me. It's really... Yeah, great in that way. And I do think describing it as, there's obviously those Skyrim-esque influences, but I do like the Minecraft comparison or something like that, because that's definitely part of it. And I can see that, like, this would... I'm kind of curious how this game will go over with, like, kids because of the difficulty level in some areas. But I can also see, I think it's speaking a language that some parts of mainstream gaming have maybe been slow to catch up to, given the Minecraft boom.
Yeah.
And I can see them loving that about it. And that there's a lot of kids who probably... aren't as into like linear experiences, you know, because that's if they grew up playing Minecraft, that's not what they got there. So it's an interesting thing.
Yeah. You know?
So other things to talk about, the aesthetics of this game. Holy crap. It's so fucking beautiful. And it is a achievement of art direction more than, you know, technical prowess necessarily. But the technical prowess is impressive too, because Hyrule is fucking huge. And at any given moment, you can basically see as far as the eye can see. And there are certain things that might pop in on the map in different areas, but the big landmarks are there and you can go to them. So, you know, you might see a tower way the hell off in the distance. And for the most part, I'll leave that and I'll be like, I will get there when I get there. But once in a while, I've seen a tower and been like, I'm just going to head that way. And I'm going to see what happens along the way. And maybe that tower is way further than I thought it was and I'll never actually get there. Or I will. And it's really, really tough to get up that tower because it is surrounded by enemies I am not ready for. But I'm going to figure it out, damn it. And I will. And it's just this absolute rush. Or one tower was surrounded by guardians, which are those big, like, multi-legged things that you'll see in the trailers. And I'm still not ready to kill one of those. And so I was having to, like, urge my horse on it. Like, we're just going to run. We're just going to run. And I'm going to jump off your back and try to get up that tower. And eventually I figured it out. And it was just such this amazing rush. So I'm getting off track again. But the game is so absurdly beautiful. I love the art direction. I said this from the trailers, and it feels even more true now that I'm playing it. The mix of the art direction and the kind of art, painterly art style it favors, plus the very gentle and very unique soundtrack it has. This is not just a unique soundtrack for Zelda, but for gaming in general, because it's often fairly ambient. Sometimes there is no soundtrack. Sometimes it's just stray piano notes. But it really evokes that sense of kind of the wild and nature and all these things. It feels like you're playing a Studio Ghibli movie. And, you know, the art style is clearly has some of those Miyazaki influences to it. And, you know, more so than, and I said this before about, like, Ni No Kuni has some of that because it is literally Studio Ghibli and Joe Hisaishi. But for some reason, like, the real thing doesn't feel as real to me as the actual experience of Breath of the Wild, because I think Breath of the Wild captures something about the experiential nature of that, that like a literal reconstruction maybe couldn't get.
Yeah, and it also seems like there's something about the sort of the narrative, like in thematic stylings of it, evoke very much a Princess Mononoke, even though someone who hasn't really played it yet. Like just like looking at it and seeing the trailers and seeing some gameplay now that has come out and stuff, and even just like the little tiny bit I played with your Switch before this podcast, like it definitely had a Mononoke Hime kind of thing going on there.
Absolutely. Or I've also thought a lot of Castle in the Sky. Like sure, if you look at how its specific brand of like techno steampunk kind of thing is very Miyazaki-esque, where it's technology infused with nature and not technology sort of separate from nature, which is very interesting. But just wherever you go, whatever you do, you will see absolutely beautiful sights. The game is very smart about whenever like you leave a shrine or a dungeon or something like that, you are stepping out onto a horizon, and I have taken so many screenshots of those, and I've tweeted some of them because it's just so beautiful. The weather and light system in this game, like going from morning to noon to night, and all the things you see, every phase of that is beautiful in different ways. But as with the best of these games, the sunset phase is the one where your jaw will truly drop because the colors that come out there are just incredible. So, yeah, there are some frame rate dips here and there, but this is, I think, just one of the most beautiful games ever made, and it's running on this sort of mobile piece of hardware. It's a really interesting, I think, engineering feat that this thing was able to pull that off. And that's the first game on this system. So assumedly, you know, game developers will get better and better at using it. And I think it really bodes well for, you know, you couldn't necessarily do this with a hyper-realistic art style, but because it's so stylized and painterly and all that, you know, you don't really notice that the textures are low res. That doesn't matter for this game.
Right.
You know, as I said, the music is so beautiful. I love how piano-driven it is. I love piano-driven scores, and I think the minimalism of it accompanies this game just beautifully, perfectly. You know, there's so many gameplay systems that sometimes you have to just take a step back and realize how crazy it is that it exists. Like, that Link can climb up every surface in this game. This is not Tomb Raider or Uncharted, where there are very specific visual cues of this is where you climb and you don't climb anywhere else. And in those games, it doesn't really bother you, but I honestly might find it hard to go back to that in some cases, because with this, it's just, if you see it, you can climb it, and sometimes you might have to get some stamina boosts and things like that, but it is there. The world is your oyster. It's amazing. Yeah.
Awesome. So obviously you haven't finished it yet, so this might be kind of a hard question to answer. But something I've been thinking about now that this game is out, and sort of like looking forward, like, do you see the next like big 3D Legend of Zelda game being like Breath of the Wild? Like, can you see them making another world like this? Or does it like seem like there's no way to do that again unless it's like, it would have to be like 10 years later or something to be able to make a game that would be able to top this?
I have no idea. It's a great question, but it's such a singular experience. I don't know how you do a sequel to it.
Yeah.
Like, even more so than something like Ocarina of Time is brilliant and singular and all those things, but it's already built off the structure of A Link to the Past, and it has a very repeatable structure.
Yeah, and it has, like, a more straightforward sort of, like, linear narrative experience, even if it has the open world, like, you know, you can go off and do weird side quests and find weird corners of the world, but it is, like, a story that's like has a beginning, middle, and end that is all like very clear and structured. Yeah. Unlike Breath of the Wild, like you say, that has a beginning and an end, but everything in between is whatever you make of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, play this game for 30 minutes and you'll realize why it took like 6 years to develop.
Yeah,
that's another part of it. Is I just like the development time on this. I don't think you can get faster with it. I think exactly. It just requires what it is. But yeah, I mean. There's an element to Breath of the Wild, not just in its singularity, where it just feels... It is definitely a Zelda game, and I love how much it retains the identity of The Legend of Zelda, but it is also such a singular experience, you wonder how it's... if it is at all repeatable. But the other thing about it in that regard is that it kind of feels cumulative. It feels like the last Legend of Zelda game in some ways. Like, it exists in this state, kind of like in our other podcast we talked about Logan, and that Logan sort of feels like it is of the X-Men continuity, but it is also separate from it. Legend of Zelda, like Breath of the Wild, the more I play of it and the more I uncover the story, it kind of feels like it's built to feel like every other Legend of Zelda game happened. It happened at some point in this world's history, but we are at like the furthest edge of it. And there are references in the game, either in the mechanics or in the story or in the music, to A Link to the Past and Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask and The Wind Waker and Twilight Princess. All of these games, they are in there in some way. You know, there are places where you're like, oh, this specific backstory, I think that's A Link to the Past or something. But it's not as literal as that. It's not that that literally happened, but it's like it's the Ura Legend of Zelda, like you were talking about with if you listen to our Logan podcast. It is like all Legend of Zelda happened here, and now you're at kind of this furthest point where we're trying to like stop the cycle or something. And I could very easily see Eiji Aonuma or Shigeru Miyamoto in a couple of months saying, we're not sure what we're going to do with Legend of Zelda, because that was kind of the accumulation for us of what this series has been, because it really does feel like it pays homage to all parts of Zelda and then kind of tries to create the ultimate definitive stance on this. Like, the brilliance of that, most of the story took place in the past, 100 years ago, and Link is trying to piece that together as he tries to undo the Calamity Ganon. And that, I love that they call Ganon Calamity Ganon in this. He is not personified. Maybe he will be when I get there at the end.
I mean, you're going to get up there and he's going to be like a cowboy lady because it's Calamity Ganon is Calamity.
I wasn't thinking of that.
Yeah. But every time I've like, I love the term Calamity Ganon, but for whatever reason, like when I first saw that in that one trailer, I just immediately in my mind made that Calamity Jane joke and I'm like, well, fuck, that's ruined forever for me because I'm never going to be able to think of Calamity Ganon and not think of Calamity Jane now.
But the whole point is that, you know, Ganon in this game, he's not Ganondorf. He's not a person walking around.
He's global warming.
He's global. He's any kind of major event that like recurs over human history and destroys things, and you are trying to put some kind of end to that, and that alone, like that goal and this being such an expansive Hyrule and it having bits and pieces of every other Legend of Zelda game in it, really does make it feel like such accumulation. It makes it even harder for me to say, where do you go after this?
Yeah.
Like, the honest answer for me is the next mainline Legend of Zelda game should be some kind of throwback, like another Link Between Worlds or something like that, where maybe you rethink how 2D Zelda works rather than going further with the 3D Zelda thing, because I just don't know how you even touch it. Or maybe the next one doesn't have to be open world at all. Maybe it's more of an Uncharted kind of thing. I don't know, but like, it's one of those moments in gaming where you look at it and you're like, I don't know how you follow up on this, because this feels like a moment out of time. Like, clearly this was influenced by the generation of gaming we're in. It's also looking so far beyond what this time is and what a game can be in this moment. Honestly, it is the best argument Nintendo will ever have for their philosophy that they're focused more on, you know, like, game design than technological prowess in their console, because they made the fucking Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild with this, you know, NVIDIA Tegra processor on a cartridge where the overall storage size of the cart is in this, but the game itself is only 13 gigs large,
right,
and things like that. And it's like, for most people, they're never going to play a game that feels as big as this. It's incredible. So yeah, I the honest answer is I don't know, but that's also exciting. How often do you get to say that about a video game series, that they create something and you're like, I have no idea where they go with this next?
Yeah.
But in a good way, not like, you play Final Fantasy 13-2 and you're like, I have no idea where you're going with this.
Yeah.
It's not that.
Or it's like the end of Halo 5 or something. You're like, right. Oh, what the fuck are you guys doing with this?
Yeah, exactly. It's none of those things. So, man, I cannot wait to get home and play more of this. And, I don't know, take it to work with me and just close my office door and pretend I'm working and play Breath. I'm not really going to do that. But, yeah.
Do you think the next thing they do is they finally make The Legend of Zelda 3? After all these years, these many decades...
That's what they do, is they, it's like, fuck the, like, top-down or the 3D, we're gonna go back to side-scrolling Zelda 3.
Yeah, like, the weird, like, Zelda 2 thing of, like, it's like a top-down, like, Final Fantasy world map, but then you go 2D side-scrolling levels, but we're gonna do that, and we're gonna do it with, like, incredible, like, modern, like, beautiful manga-inspired graphics or something. It's just gonna be, like, this insane, massive, weird 2D, 2.5D adventure. The Legend of Zelda 3.
Yeah, I don't know, but I think this is one of those moments in Nintendo history, and it's so exciting to be here for it on the ground floor and play this game. And for me, who has always kind of played catch-up with Legend of Zelda, it's so fun to be here on the ground floor and, like, playing a game that, you know, the guides are not all out there yet.
Right.
And I have not heard of everything this game has to offer through the grapevine in some way. Not that I have with other Zeldas, but, like, you know, there are certain things, like, I know Link's Awakening ends with it being a dream and the Windfish and that right, stuff. Yeah. I don't get to discover that, because it's like watching Citizen Kane and not knowing that Rosebud is the sled.
Right.
But with Breath of the Wild, it is this completely fresh experience, and we're all on that same page, and it's super fucking cool. So, if you have a Wii U and you don't want to get a Switch, get it for that. It runs...
Yeah, it seems like I've watched the Digital Foundry video, and it seems like it runs totally acceptably.
Yeah, like, you know, you might get a little better experience with the Switch for a couple of reasons, but you're not gonna... It's not a different game.
Yeah, and it's not like the, like, Xbox 360 version of Shadow of Mordor or, like, Watch Dogs or something like that.
Exactly. So, you know, but my last word would be, if you don't have either of those systems and you really want to play this game and you feel like the Switch is something you want, I say go for it. There are certain things this console is lacking at launch, but it is running fucking Breath of the Wild, and you can take it on the go with you if you want, or you can dock it or whatever. Fucking cool. So, yeah.
Cool.
Hell of a game. Yeah. So, any other thoughts or questions on Zelda before we wrap this up?
I'm still thinking about Legend of Zelda 3 over here, man. I'm in the future. I'm in a future moment. You're just here talking about Breath of the Wild. Fuck that. Legend of Zelda 3. Let's get on it.